Gravity-fed water filters. That is the magic word for guaranteeing you pure fresh water regardless of what happens. You can find a river, stream, some source, any source of water. These filters will make them pure as the driven snow. Berkey's been a big name in filters for a long time, and we've had many sponsors to sell Berkey filters all over the years. And we have a new relationship with GetBerkey.com, and let me tell you why. Because not only do they have excellent supply of British Berkfield, as well as the American Berkey, but they also sell an array of filters that are the ceramic variety, you know, the ones that James McKinney has mentioned and recommended. So now you can go to GetBerkey.com and custom build the perfect system for you, a stainless steel, the plastic, the British Berkfield, the Berkey, the ceramic, the typical black filters. You know, there were some problems a while ago with the black filters. I had some that leaked as well. But that has all been fixed, and I'm confident they're okay. But since then, people have kind of went to the ceramic filters, like Dalton. And so I really appreciate people at Get Berkey for putting together all these systems to let you choose. No one's forcing you to take any particular brand or variety. They'll educate you on the website about what is what and how to do to combine them. So what you need to do is go to our website and click through on our links to Get Berkey. That's Berkey, the British Berkfield, and the Dalton filters, all there, the ceramic as well as the black filters. GetBerkey.com, and tell them Beat the Fire sent you. So click through on our links to Get Berkey, and you will get Berkey. Also, for Feet to Fire listeners, people at Get Berkey has put together a coupon for 5% off your purchase. 5% off your purchase. Just put in F2F. That's a digit 2, F2F, as a coupon code to get an additional 5% off. And, of course, orders over $25 are free shipping. So there you go. Get Berkey and Feet to Fire. What a team.
James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada.
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the how to participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at F2F at innersights.com. That's F2F at INNERSITES.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancey.
Stay in time, don't get out of line.
Well, you know, our next guest did not take that advice too well, stay in line, as Douglas Dietrich. He's been out a couple times before talking about World War II and about the Satanists running loose and running, actually, part of the military, who God knows who, all of it. Controversial stuff. I've got a few emails. People weren't too comfortable with it. And other people were pretty amazed by it. And that sums up Douglas Dietrich's information. This show is going to be no less amazing. The real Roswell stories we'll be going into today. Could it be what crashed at Roswell was really a balloon, but one of far superior technical advances that carried a futuristic designed suicide bomber from Japan on the jet stream winds in World War II? Could it be that Roswell was the site for a secret prison camp that thought to persuade the captured high-tech balloon people, a plane and the crew, to demonstrate how it worked, and they intentionally blew up the hydrogen-filled compartments, killing and burning themselves and crashing in their metallicized rubber dirigible and manta-wing plane, causing the now infamous and distorted Roswell crash reports? Douglas returns to Feet the Fire to provide the proof and rational arguments from the documents he read, noted, and sometimes stole before he destroyed them as his job as assistant librarian at Presidio Naval Base in California. And we have rest of his bio on the page. The webpage is DouglasDietrich.com. As I remember him saying, Diet Rich, DouglasDietrich.com. And welcome back, Douglas.
Yes, thank you so much, sir. It's great to be here, and I'm most honored to be with your audience in Chicago. And thank you, all of you, for spending the most valuable time that you have with us, and it's your most valuable possession, and it's on a St. Patrick's Day weekend at that. So happy St. Patrick's Day weekend, and this is actually the commemoration approaching for a very tragic period in my life, which was the death of my mother as a direct result of my coming out with this information. And with your permission, Mr. Yanchik, I'd like to go into that for a moment.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically what had happened was a year ago today, plus a few months, on the last Saturday of the first month of last year, January 29th of 2011, the executrix of the Mutual UFO Network, which is an investigative society that's been around for quite some time. It's not a belief society. It's not a society of UFO believers trying to contact Space Brothers. This has its foundations from the 1950s when people wanted to investigate ufological phenomena. And she has a number of degrees, and she used to host Sacramento's Channel 17 Watch the Skies program concerning ufological phenomena. And so she was the executive, female executive for the Mutual UFO Network in Sacramento, and she gave me an opportunity to speak about this, and it was so controversial that we were forced to delay advertising until the 1 week before the event itself. And even what little advertising we were able to get out by that time resulted in the highest attendance that they ever experienced, so much so that it exceeded the safety capacity in terms of fire safety standards for the venue in which we housed the event. And so I was able to get a recording of it, and it was where I put on public display some of the Roswell debris, prize element of the Roswell debris, which had some of the so-called aeroglyphs, still had some of the paint on it, still had some of the metallic components and rivets on it, and it more than likely was either a piece of the girder system of the super dirigible itself or one of its parasite craft. And so it's essentially Japanese aluminum. And I put this on display to people to let them know that this was what one of many pieces of debris that I had given to the Japanese people when I returned the Roswell debris to them that I absconded with from the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco when I had worked with the Roswell files. It had resulted in probably the greatest sea change in the world economy that had occurred probably in some ways in modern human history, certainly post-ceasefire and post-war human history, because it changed Japanese-American relations for the worst, led to a big Japanese divestment in the United States, and the United States was paying the price for it ever since. And so the end result was that when I put that on display with my personal name attached to it this time, I came home to find my mother dying, and she was on the floor on top of two portraits that were smashed beneath her. This was physically impossible to have happened without outside interference, because she had a safety strap on her bed. She had suffered from multiple catastrophic brain injuries in her later adult life. She needed a lot of adult care and supervision, and I had people tending to her throughout the day who were coming in at various hours, and they were checking on her, well, especially while I was in Sacramento. And during that one period of time when they were switching shifts, and there were people that weren't present for maybe 15 minutes, a half an hour, somebody had broken into the house. And her safety straps were not undone, and she was smashed onto the floor. And I brought her to the hospital, where they took several magnetic resonance images of her chest to see if her heart was in okay condition after that fall. And they found out that her main vein leading to her heart, the main artery, known as the aorta, was perfectly dissected by laser-like incisions, and yet there were no external bruises, markings, contusions whatsoever. So they knew I didn't have the technology to do this, and that's what they attributed it to, some high technology that had cut her vein so finely that it had not yet split, but they had expected her, just by the sheer pressure of the blood pumping through her veins, to die any second. And they told me that, but she lingered on for months. We had a lot of people praying for her and a lot of people putting psychic energy into keeping her alive. But then she died on March 19th of last year, and we're heading up on that commemorative anniversary. And if we're to have her death have any meaning, then we'd best get on with explaining a lot of, you know, what happened and what was the reality behind Roswell. And so these are one of the things that I'll have to explain, was the initial exposure of the Roswell debris that led to the severance between Japan and America economically, and the rise of China. And that was in 1995. And what had happened was, at that time, I had taken the materials I had absconded with from the Presidio military base. As a matter of fact, I had better start to explain how I'd gotten that first. I've explained it enough times before on this program where it may sound a bit redundant, so I apologize to people who have heard this before. But I was a Department of Defense research librarian for almost a decade. And during that period of time, I was given an inordinate amount of responsibilities that I was never supposed to have. I had the bottom level of security clearance you could hold. It was absolute rock bottom, just top secret level. Top secret, by the way, is the absolute rock bottom of security level clearances. So if someone is in the military who's a relative or a friend of yours, and they're bragging to you about their top secret clearance and what it allows them to see, you can really dismiss a lot of what they're saying as a storied anecdote, because the reality is that there are multiple letter gradations and numeric gradations after that, which add to your level of security clearance. And to put this into perspective for you, the President of the United States, who's usually in office for only 4 to 8 years, has a much lower security clearance than any general, because any high officer, particularly a general, is going to be in for 30 years, probably on contract in retirement for another 10 years. So they're going to be around for like almost half a century of access to secrets that the president is never going to see. And as a result, their security clearance levels are exceptionally high. My operations manager at the Presidio Military Base Library, where I was stationed as a civilian for working for the Department of Defense on a military base, a Department of Defense library within the Western Defense Command Center, the headquarters for the United States 6th Army at the time, ultimately later to be closed due to an enormous amount of monstrous scandals, which we've discussed, concerning Satanism, which, believe it or not, also plays into this story quite heavily, far more heavily than most people would imagine. While I was working there, the operations manager, who had a far higher level of security clearance, like so many other people working for the government, was extremely lazy, incompetent, corrupt, and didn't want to do any work. Well, to put this into perspective for you, when the Roswell files arrived for him to collate so that he could take elements of those files and bring them to the Presidio Military Base Commandant, who wanted elements of those files for his own reasons, which were never articulated, he came to me to do the work. And one might ask, well, why would the Roswell files be shared with someone who was the commandant of the Presidio Military Base? Well, the Presidio Military Base was one of the most important bases in the United States constellation of military bases. And it took a series of scandals so monstrous, like I've explained before, 500,000 children infected with AIDS by a child molestation cult. It took things like that, a attempted hit on presidential candidate William Jefferson Clinton was organized on base. It took enormous scandals like that to close that base down. And so at that time, it was still operating. And it was also between World War I and World War II, before Area 51 ever existed, the Area 51 of its day. It was where they used to test nautical biplanes for the United States Army and Naval Aviation out of Crissy Fields, that little spit of sand that exists there even today as part of a civilian national park. So people could go and visit and see where they used to test nautical biplanes on that spit of sand and out pointing out towards the ocean. So it had a huge naval aviation history, and Army aviation and naval aviation history as a testing ground protected by the entire U.S. 6th Army. And more than that, at the time of the Roswell incident, there was no such thing as an Air Force. So everything dealing with the Roswell incident was still under Army venue. So that's what people don't understand. Area 51 is a CIA base, but it was originally Tonopah Army Airfield. So Tonopah Army Airfield was connected to the CIA specifically to prevent evidence of the Roswell incident from going to the FBI. And because Hoover was demanding bits of information about it, he was demanding evidence, he demanded to see what was going on. So there's an entire amount of politics behind that, such as the Japanese internment, his refusal to partake in it aggressively, which forced the Army to basically run the Japanese internment camps, etc. He would have known what he was looking at. He would have had the integrity to have broken it to the American public, and that was why Area 51 was created under CIA auspice, was specifically to keep the FBI from getting a hold of debris and evidence from the Roswell incident, specifically. And so the Army still had access to those materials, and the Commandant demanded to look at them. Well, at the time that my operations manager was supposed to work with collating said documents, he brought me into the room where they had been shipped to. And he said, Dietrich, I want you to start to get to work on these documents. And I looked at them, and I saw over a dozen very heavy wooden locker boxes like we used to have from the Spanish-American War all the way up through World War II. They were lined with metal corners so that they would survive damage if thrown off of a speeding freight train, so to speak, or at least that was the intent. They were meant to take a lot of damage, heavy, like kind of like the wooden foot lockers you'd find at the foot of the bed of a military bunk bed. And so my job had always been to open up these documents, look inside, collate them, make sure the right ones were slated for destruction, put them in the incinerators. This was a different case. But on what made it particularly different, because not just because we weren't destroying them, but collating them for someone to actually review, was the fact that they had security clearances on them that I had never seen. They looked like something out of a comic book. Each one of them had the codex of cryptocosmic top secret. And stapled on the Cryptocosmic Top Secret label was another ancillary label that said above. So above Cryptocosmic Top Secret.
I mean, I find it's almost comical that the names they use. I mean, Cosmic Crypto.
Oh, yeah, it's just preposterous. Cryptocosmic Top Secret.
Of course, my first introduction to it, when I finally learned what VHF stands for, mm-hmm. and UHF, very high frequency, and ultra high frequency. So I guess that, you know, kind of goes involved there. And then it'd be like really, really, really high frequency would be the next one.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And it was something that made me think at first. My reaction was that was a joke, but that was not the case. And at any rate, I told them, I can't even look at these or review these documents because if I do, I could very well spend the rest of my life in jail. And of course, I got the usual response where I was forced to work under protest. And that response was, Dietrich, if you don't get to work on these documents, I'm going to tell the MPs on this base, you try to walk out with some of those materials underneath your armpit, you will spend the rest of your life in jail. And so as always, no matter what protestations I lodged against him, you know, sir, I don't think, you know, his response, of course, is, of course you don't think. You work for the government. Now get to work. And so when I'm working with all of these documents, keep in mind, it's not simply these documents that I'm looking at that put the entire Roswell incident into perspective. I've spoken on this show before and others about how World War II really ended, which was essentially with an American loss in the Pacific. And people who don't believe that also don't understand that we are still legally at war with the Third Reich. I mean, to put this into perspective for you, before World War II, any great-great-grandparent that anybody had grown up with who had lived through World War I, if you had asked them and their memory was strong, would confirm that before World War II, there was no such thing as daylight savings. There was no such thing as federal income tax. World War II started all of that. These were emergency measures that were only supposed to last during wartime against the Third Reich. Well, none of them have ever been repealed. You're still paying federal income taxes. You still are under daylight savings. You're still mobilized for war against the Third Reich. That surrender could never be taken because Roosevelt said he wouldn't take any surrender from the Nazi Party, which had been legally elected, and as a result, all it could take was ceasefires in the field. Since the Nazi Party was declared a criminal party, he would not negotiate with. As a result, no national surrender was ever negotiated. Now, in Japan's case, what was negotiated was a peace, and originally it was a ceasefire in 1945, and the peace treaty was not signed between Japan and America until September 8th of 1951 on the Presidio Military Base, documents of which I dealt with and destroyed, because the Presidio Military Base was a United Nations base. It was originally where the United Nations was founded in January 1st, 1942, just a week and a few days after Pearl Harbor. And about 3 weeks and 3 days, to be exact, after Pearl Harbor. And so that's what I was contending with, was mostly United Nations documents. This was something different. It was specifically Army. And that's the thing about the Roswell incident. No one from the government has ever spoken to Roswell. There's been no member of the White House, been no member of any federal branch of judiciary, House or Senate or executive that's spoken to Roswell. The only people who have spoken to Roswell publicly have been the United States Air Force, which did not exist at the time of the Roswell incident. And whenever they say, oh, yeah, well, by the way, we got, the Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Wendell, in September of 1994, drafted a release of security oath for the Air Force for the Roswell incident. And they started speaking to all of this and retelling the stories over and over again. And people never were given the information. There was no Air Force in July of 1947. It was an Army incident. And only those who switched to the Air Force talked only 25% of the time, and they didn't even know half the time what they were talking about, because there are so many elements to this story, and everybody sees only a piece of it. But in terms of working with these documents, I absconded with some of the debris. And so what had happened was, later on, I gave it to Japan, and on November 17th of 1995, Robert Dean, a UFO researcher, announced on Ken Schramm's Town Meeting, which was a very popular Washington and Oregon State TV show at the time, that the objective of Japan for July of 1996 was to open up the Hakui City, H-A-K-U-I, Hakui City UFO Museum, which was to have the Roswell debris as its center focus. And he even expressed the fact that they had sunk $50 million into it. And in truth, it was actually far more that had been sunk into the Hakui City UFO Museum. And so then what had happened was other people spoke about this in Britain, and that British UFO researcher Colin Andrews spoke to it.
Let me stop for 1 second. This debris you had, is this something that you got from your Presidio?
That's correct.
Okay, from the locker boxes. I thought so, but I wanted to be sure. Okay.
Yeah, just to confirm that. And so
you don't have that anymore, though, or is that?
I do.
You do?
I do. They returned the prize bit of debris to me. The rest, they actually interred in family shrines in Japan, because the people who died at the Roswell incident were Japanese prisoners of war, and many of them had sourced from Hakui City. And so that was the whole reason behind it. So what had happened was, while I was contending with this anonymously, See, all of this was being dealt with through Teleport USA. And Teleport USA was the Hakui City subsidiary that basically was dealing between Hakui City and the United States in Los Angeles, was where they were headquartered. And so when I was dealing with them, they were starting up a tourist package that was going to have a lot of ufologists speaking at a convention. And so all of this was being taken very seriously. And then the United States Army started on its disinformation campaign. And what they did was they took even more debris from the boxes. I didn't steal all of the debris. There's only so much I could carry. But they sent a whole bunch of it to Art Bell on April 18th of 1996 with a disinformation letter claiming that these were extraterrestrial. And they became known as Art's Parts. And on May 19th of 1996, Linda Moulton Howe took them for electron dispersion spectroscopy. And this is so important because all of the universe is made of the same star stuff. We all source from the same creation source, the same Big Bang. So, but like a fingerprint, every different solar system will have a different amount of metallic readings in terms of its debris. This is how we can tell alien meteorites. We can tell meteorites and discern them as being extraterrestrial in origin based on electron dispersion spectroscopy. Well, this spectroscopy proved, per Linda Moulton Howe, that this was all 100% pure Japanese aluminum. And so Art's Parts went into oblivion, and they never spoke about it much more, but this was part of that Army disinformation campaign. It was very similar to what was done, as I brought up in one of our shows before, about Annie Jacobson, because when I conducted my presentation on Roswell and came out into the public with my name and face behind the debris, allowing people to touch it and hold it, I had them wear gloves so that their bodily oils or secretions from their hands or fingers wouldn't begin to disintegrate or compromise the paint on the debris. But I had them look at the symbols and whatever else they wanted to look at, and of course kept a careful eye on it. But aside from coming home to a dying mother, one of the things that happened was that Annie Jacobson, who had been working on the book titled Area 51 for 5 years, for half a decade, working with the CIA, coming up with an extremely well-detailed, well-footnoted historical presentation piece that was irrefutable and inarguable in terms of everyone vetting what it had to say in content. She was approached by the U.S. government, and her book was going to be published in March, the same month my mother would wind up dying. It was released for publication on the same day that my mother died. And so the U.S. government approached her and said, we want 7 pages tacked on. And so they tacked on 7 pages. She tacked on. She agreed to it. She sold out. And she tacked on 7 pages, which make absolutely no sense in context of the rest of the book. They're a totally nonsensical juxtaposition of historical odds and ends, where she says that the Nazi Dr. Mengele created a bunch of deformed children to fly a Horton flying wing into Roswell on behalf of the Soviets, and so that Stalin could create a War of the Worlds type scare. Which, of course, wouldn't work very well out in the middle of the effing desert. At any rate, it's hard enough for an adult to fly a Horton flying wing. It's a pretty tricky plane to fly. It's got no tail, so the stability is very different, requires an experienced pilot. And to have children who are deformed and dealing with all the issues consequent to deformity flying it, it's just preposterous. And it elicited a lot of anger, a lot of confusion, which is exactly what it was meant to do. It destroyed her career in terms of reputation, as well it should have. And the end result was just another disinformation campaign on the part of the U.S. government at the time that I was revealing all of this. And note the times that these things take place. And, for instance, the Hakui City Museum, what led to its downfall was that President Clinton slapped the toughest trade sanctions on Japan that had ever been slapped on it. Basically, he ended a lot of Japan's quotas against imports and exports concerning the United States. And as a result, Japan resulted in divesting from the United States and revesting in communist China. And it was at that moment that Americans began to think, oh, the Japanese economy has collapsed. You know, and that was not the case at all. The yen has risen tremendously since that period of time against the U.S. dollar, and even more so against the British pound.
All right, hold on. If we could put a mark there, because we're going to have to stop for break.
Yeah.
And we can come back on the other side. This is a lot of groundwork being laid for what we're going to see, which is amazing stuff. I have the DVD that's available. And we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
What does hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, blizzards, floods, earthquakes, volcanoes, civil unrest, martial law, and even the passage of Planet X have in common? The loss of electrical power. And when you stop to think about it, what aspect of our lives is not dependent on electricity? Time to think about solar and wind energies. Solar Sphere offers you a wide selection of solar-powered gadgets, chargers, and complete panel systems. And the Home Wind Company offers complete wind power from the smallest to the largest electrical needs, including do-it-yourself kits. Simply meander over to our website at feet2fire.com and look at the solar gadgets and the wind turbine ads and click your way to take back your power from the whims of weather, disaster, and politics. Generators only last as long as you have fuel. So turn to the sun at Solar Sphere and turn to the wind at Home Wind. When you hear the word addiction, perhaps you think of extremes such as alcoholics and heroin addicts. But actually, millions of people are walking around with brain chemistry that causes feelings of sadness, emptiness, and emotional pain that have driven people to be addicted to tobacco, food, and even TV. Anything to momentarily divert the attention from those feelings, at whatever cost. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man. It's all right. He knows of their fear in the forthcoming fight. Soon there'll be blood and many will die. Mothers and fathers back home they will cry.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada.
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feet2fire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the how to participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. That's f2f@innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
All right, we are back talking with Douglas Dietrich. The topic is the real story behind Roswell, and it's a doozy. I've done a lot of shows at Roswell, and the interesting part, if you can see his DVD, which I understand he'd be doing another version of it because of technical issues, but the data in there is absolutely amazing. And a lot of the stuff you hear about people saying, well, you know, I had top secret this, I heard that, and they don't have anything to show from it. Well, in this case, there's many pictures, diagrams, et cetera, to show back up a lot of this evidence we have yet to get to. This is just sitting in the groundwork, so hold on to your seats. And welcome back, Douglas.
Yeah, thanks so much. And I just want to clarify that the in terms of the there's no technical difficulties with the DVDs per se. They worked absolutely perfectly. And what we're
production,
talking about,
I guess. I mean, production. I guess I should say.
Oh yeah. What we may do at some point in the future would be another produced version of it. But that's not going to be anytime soon because we're going to reproduce all of the contents with a heavily illustrated book that will be released at the first premier UFOCon or UFO convention that's going to be co-produced by my executrix Lorian Fenton and Mr. Conspiracy Brian William Hall. And we'll plug that towards the very end of the interview just so that people are aware of it and can make note of it. That's not going to be until probably September of this year. It's scheduled for, and that, of course, is all accessible, all that information through my website. But for right now, we're just selling the DVDs until they run out. We have very few left, and we're putting them together as a DVD set. And it's very fitting, actually, Roswell and the Rising Sun and Satan's Crusaders, which talks about my decade of liaisonship with the only officially recognized satanic chaplain in the world, which was recognized by the United States Army. And my liaisonship, by the way, was not voluntary. I was assigned. I was not a member of the Church of Satan nor the Temple of Set, which was the adversary church set up in kind of like a rivalry to the Church of Satan after there was an infernal schism between Anton Vandor LaVey, the Black Pope of the Church of Satan, and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, who had a lot to do with creating the Roswell myth that so many people buy into today. But we'd best go into exactly how we got to that point first in terms of just covering this debris in Hakui City because it is so important. President Clinton, as I said, ratified the toughest trade agreement imposed against Japan in the post-war era. It ended many of Japan's import quotas against American goods and thereby pressured Japan to withdraw from its UFO display plans which would have exposed to the world how the Second World War really ended and implicated the United States High Command of the World War II era in international war crimes. And on June 12th of 1996, Teleport USA announced that Cosmo Isle, Hakui City Museum Symposium, scheduled for July 19th through the 21st, the tour set for July 16th through the 23rd of that year, had been canceled. And this sad reality was the inception point of what in Japan was jokingly referred to as the Roswell crash. And it ushered in an age of apparent stagnation for Japan, an age of massive reorientation of Japan's economy away from aggressively exporting to the American market and instead investing into the mega techniques of quietly developing Chinese mass production. And so the way that they did this was through producers' goods, items that are invisible to the consumer but are critical to the world economy. Such goods include highly miniaturized components, advanced materials, super precise machines, the same kind of stuff that went into building the super dirigibles that ultimately crashed and burned at Roswell. And so in terms of that, since that period of time, both China and Japan have been growing ever since. The yen has increased 65% on balance against the U.S. dollar since 1995, and it's increased like 90% against the British pound. And aside from that, the Japan's current account surplus, the widest and most meaningful measure of its trade, it totaled $36 billion in around 1990, but today it totals $194 billion, actually more than that, closer to $200 billion. And so they have the longest life expectancy in the world. Their quality of life has increased immeasurably. Their internet speeds are 10 times that of the United States. So their quality of life has only increased whereas the United States went into an incredible economic slump. Their unemployment is only 4.5%, whereas ours is over twice that much. And all of this was thanks to this rash desire to protect a bunch of old military and science and basically, I call it a group of soldiers, scientists, Satanists, and spies who basically were behind turning the Roswell incident into the modern myth that so many people accept so unquestioningly today. And so how did this myth start? Basically, we've talked about the debris. We've talked about its impact on the world economy, how importantly that the Americans take it so that they destroyed their own economy to protect the hides of a bunch of senior citizens who were involved in this. We've discussed what happened to me in terms of my personal tragedy, and now we're going to discuss how exactly did this incept. Actually, we should start talking about it after the Roswell incident, because it started with Sergeant Melvin Brown. And Sergeant Melvin Brown was on guard duty at the impact site. He was ordered to climb into a truck carrying the so-called alien bodies, and he was further admonished not to look under the tarps to cover them, that covered them. While no one was noticing, he violated the orders and he took a peek, and what Brown saw was this so-called alien flight crew, and he described them as small in size with yellow skin that had been burned orange. Not gray. They turned gray later with decomposition and when rigor mortis set in. Now, what had happened was in 1969, when man landed on the moon in July of 69, Melvin Brown turned around to his family and he said he once saw the remains of a spacecraft full of enemy aliens. And he was using the military term for Japanese prisoners of war. And he said, and the craft they were involved in, his whole family didn't know what he was talking about. And they said, oh, he says he saw aliens. And the reason this is so important was because this was July of 1969, and it has this whole history which veers into the Satanism. And that whole trip was Colonel Michael Aquino, who I had worked with as a liaison, who was a member of the Church of Satan. He had basically originally graduated from the UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, went on his first tour of duty at Fort Bragg with the 82nd Airborne Division as a cavalry officer, then as a psychological warfare expert with what they call PSYOP, P-S-Y-O-P, all caps. He worked with PSYOP for Special Forces in the JFK Special Warfare Center. While he was on leave in San Francisco in March of 1969, before Sergeant Brown started talking, he attended a lecture at the Black House and met Anton LaVey and converted to Satanism. He went back to Fort Bragg, started his first satanic rituals, sometimes with his fellow officers participating, and they began to notice the incredible effects this had on psychological impact of the people around them. Now, in June of 1969, Aquino embarked on his tour of duty in Vietnam with the 6th PSYOP Battalion in 3rd Corps Tactical Zone, South Vietnam. He gets called back in 1969 after his year of tour of duty, and he's presented with Melvin Brown and starting to talk. And he was presented with the original Roswell incident, which we all know what happened, and I can go into detail on that and will. But this is how he looked on it as a challenge. His take on it was he had to hide the fact that a bunch of Japanese prisoners of war killed themselves in an experimental, unconventional weapons delivery system that was flying over New Mexico. And his response to it was to create this whole artificial mythology that has been fed to the people ever since with a lot of military plants. Now, one of these plants would be, of course, Stanton Friedman. Stanton Friedman was working with development of the Convair NBH 36, which was a converted B-32 or B-36 bomber that they said was nuclear flight. And this was all part of the scam that they were pulling to juice the taxpayers for literally millions and millions of dollars. Went to well over $1 billion on this baby. And this thing was flying a leaky nuclear reactor. It wasn't being powered by the reactor. It just had a leaky nuclear reactor it was carrying. Flew it all over the United States, irradiated so much of the landscape. It was famous for literally, because they kept track of this, microwaving chickens in their coops. So his response was he felt the United States was no longer even a safe place to live, and he moved up to Canada. He's been living there ever since. And now he goes around pushing Colonel Aquino's satanic agenda with pushing the Roswell myth. You have other guys like Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall. Again, a lieutenant colonel. He goes around, he visits Iraq, he's fully embedded, he comes back, he tells us, even though Iraq has been dusted with so much depleted uranium, it's got the radiological equivalent of 44,000 Hiroshima bombs that have gone off in Iraq, and he goes back and he tells us how safe it is, they're building schools there, oh, it's lovely there, yet he never moved there, and he still gets his check, and he says, by the way, it's aliens in Roswell, government doesn't want you to know it, I want you to know it. And then we have people like Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, who had an office at the Pentagon. Now, this guy, for years, works with the Pentagon. He says, oh, yeah, it was Roswell aliens, and I helped distribute the technology. I mean, the story behind it speaks for itself. He was working with William J. Burns. They wrote the book the day after Roswell. I don't know which one was more responsible, but while they worked with it, they approached Senator Strom Thurmond, who had ran against Truman as a Dixiecrat decades ago during the Roswell incident, during the time of it. During that era, and they said, we want you to write the prologue, the preface to the introduction to our book, which is about I Walked with Giants. That's what they said the title was, and it was all about Colonel Philip J. Corso's work with Eisenhower during the war, when he was a National Guardsman who had been called up and was basically one of Eisenhower's errand boys. And so, of course, Strom Thurmond saw no reason not to write an introduction for it. He wrote that introduction. They slapped it on the book the day after Roswell. And Strom Thurmond sued them. And they were able to recall every single one of those books and still get the day after Roswell out, sans that introduction by Strom Thurmond, on the very day of the Roswell anniversary, half a century after Roswell's incident. You know, literally 50 years later. There's no way you can do that if you have any experience in the publishing industry and how much effort it takes to do a recall without government aid. And so people really need to start seeing the horns on these guys' heads. They're all getting their government checks, and that government checks never stop. And if they were truly saying something, they would be in my position, where there's no government checks that are ever going to come again, even though I once worked with the U.S. government. They don't have relatives that die. They don't come home to dead relatives. They don't come home to what I came home to. And so that's with that in mind, we'll go back to the Roswell incident.
No, that's – I mean, what you're saying is very direct, very, very specific. And in the event that any of these people would like to talk to you about this on the air, would you be open to that?
Of course I'd be open to that. As a matter of fact,
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, when I was on the air with Joyce Riley, Stanton Friedman called up immediately after the show and said he wanted equal time, but apparently never came up for it. So if that happens, that'd be great. And certainly I would like to talk to them about it. And I've been set up for ambushes in the past, and that's still up there on record. So we'll... you know, it didn't. The ambushes didn't quite work out. But going back to World War II, which is what the Roswell incident is all about, what we start off with was that the military got the first idea from Goebbels' greatest military victory. Reich's propaganda minister, Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, was in charge, of course, of the Reich's propaganda ministry. His greatest job was that he was to keep the German people mobilized until the very last minute, and in this he succeeded admirably, and for that he's known as one of the few German generals who never lost a battle. He convinced the Allies that the Krautballs, as the Allies called them, they called them Foo Fighters in the Pacific, these were multi-headed magnesium flares that had super extended heads with routed coils that were wrapped all around these bars that were radio-controlled, multi-headed coils like a porcupine, and they were able to get them flying and buzzing bombers, and their whole job was simply to freak bombardier crews out and get them reporting that strange craft were following them that were potentially alien in nature. Now, Goebbels was able to tell people that the Third Reich, quite accurately and quite honestly, was the first state to ever employ television as a state medium, and they claimed that their signals had been intercepted by an alien race which recognized them as the only true government on planet Earth. And as a result, many of the more superstitious British high command people like Sir Victor Goddard, who later on was an outspoken believer in alien craft during the 1950s and was put in charge of the Massey Project, which was the British version of Project Blue Book, people like him took this to heart, and several Allied commanders took it seriously enough where they allowed the Nazi high command to evacuate because they needed a representative government in case these aliens ever landed. So when later on they found out that this had all been a Goebbels psyop, the Americans were impressed enough where they felt they could pull something like this against the American public. And that was what Aquino was assigned starting in 1969, 1970. And because keep in mind, after the Roswell incident, nobody spoke about Roswell again until that period in time. It just totally disappears off the American consciousness until that period in time. And to put this in perspective for you, at Roswell itself, what it originally was a testing ground for people like Dr. Robert Goddard. Dr. Robert Goddard launched the American Space Age, so it always had a history of space age research, and he launched it actually in the northeastern United States in March 1926 when he launched the first liquid-fueled rocket. That was the dawn of the modern space age race. And then in July of 1929, with a launch failure, Dr. Goddard's first instrumental rocket crashed, causing neighbors to obtain an injunction preventing further launches in Massachusetts. So his development was ridiculed in the press, and he became increasingly reclusive. So in November of 1929, he received a Guggenheim grant, with Charles Lindbergh's aid. And this financed the move of his rocket laboratory to the most sparsely populated area he could find in the United States. And that was Roswell, New Mexico. And then he got taken over during World War II by someone who ruined the entire rocket program as a military weapon, and that was Jack Parsons. And Jack Parsons was literally a member of the Satanic Church. Anyone could do research on this and bet this because he was quite open with being a Satanist. And what Jack Parsons did was he developed the solid fuel rocket booster. And as a result, because of this technological development, he was able to displace Goddard right through the war and begin to overtake the American space program. And so there was another satanic connection of how one technology that was produced by a Satanist was even overtaking the original guy who was doing more conventional rocket research over in Roswell, New Mexico. And this was a whole part of why they called on Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, who was a Satanist, to start propagating the Roswell myth. There was enough of a connection there where he was already familiar with the area. He was familiar with the technology. That's why they chose him over any other propagandist to work with this. And so what happened at Roswell was we had a tremendous series of Japanese super dirigibles that had helped to end the war and force the Americans into ceasefire. These were taking advantage of what was known as the jet stream. The jet stream only goes in one direction. It goes from Japan to the United States, follows the Kuroshio, the Japanese current. Jet stream's a river of air, crosses 6,000 miles of ocean, and it claimed the lives of all kinds of American airmen, thousands of them, throughout the war. And basically, the Japanese knew about it in World War II because their emperor, Hirohito, was a marine biologist. He was the only scientist till that point in history to ever head a nation state. So he was a marine biologist who was designing weapons not only to take advantage of nature, he designed them as biomimetic, meaning that they would mimic biological organisms to increase their efficiency. Americans didn't pick up on that until really recently. This man thought of this over half a century ago. Now, the swift-flowing river of air brought what were known as ICUBs, intercontinental unguided bombs, from Japan all the way to the United States. And it did so during a period of time that caused the Americans not only great distress, but had them reapproach Dr. Goddard and ask him if there was anything he could do to counteract them. And, of course, he was incensed. He said, "You've replaced me with a Satanist. You've taken my funding away. Now you ask me to destroy these bombs that are costing the Japanese $20 to build, and you ask me to build rockets that cost thousands and thousands of dollars to take them down. It's not going to work." And they asked him, "Well, what do we do?" He said, "Build an American kamikaze." And that's what the Americans responded with, a Northrop XP-79B. This was built in 1945. This was an American Ram plane that was meant to be unarmed and a ram in what Dr. Goddard predicted would be huge balloons that would be coming over, that would be piloted, that would essentially be war breakers. And as kamikaze weapons, these did their job. Several heroic test pilots died testing these craft. And that in itself is a tragedy, and it goes to show you the desperation that the Americans had at this point. And it's something they never talked to you about, any more than the NBH-36 Convair being not nuclear flight, but just a bomber carrying a leaky nuclear reactor. But to put the Kuroshio in perspective for you, because this is something that they always try to make it sound like, there's a new book out called UFOs in Wartime, in which you've got a guy who writes racist novels. If you've ever read Mac Maloney's novels about the wingman, he has America fighting Germany and Japan again and again. He portrays these enemies in the most vicious, racist way imaginable, barely human in nature. And now he wrote a book called UFOs in Wartime, in which he says, oh, the Japanese didn't have the technology for the Battle of Los Angeles, where the Japanese had originally violated American airspace with these very types of dirigibles. And to put this into perspective for you about how ridiculous what he's saying is, how racist what he's saying is, the Japanese tried to prove a long time ago, and they succeeded quite admirably, in the fact that the Japanese had centuries ago colonized the United States and left as their descendants the Zuni Indians of North America. And on June 28th, of 1980, a crew of six Japanese men sailing the Yasego 3, which was nothing more than a 43-foot double canoe catamaran built according to a design found on stone paintings back in Japan, proven to be 5,000 years old. It landed in San Francisco, having crossed the Pacific from Tokyo to San Francisco 7 days ahead of their calculated schedule. They logged 170 miles a day and traveled that 5,000 miles propelled only by the winds and the current in a boat which was equipped only with sails, a rudder, and a centerboard. And almost two decades before the Yasego Trix made its voyage, on June 14th of 1962, before I was born, the San Francisco Chronicle reported a young Japanese man had sailed alone in a 19-foot sloop from Osaka, Kobe to San Francisco, and it took him 73 days from May 12th through July 24th of that year, and only because he had endured five storms along the way. This is why all the stuff that they're feeding you about Fukushima Daiichi rendering two-thirds of Japan uninhabitable is so preposterous, because if that were the case, we'd have 20 million Japanese boat people on the west coast of North America by now. So the idea that submarines and balloons can't make it across the Pacific is preposterous. And make it across the Pacific they did throughout the war. They conducted reconnaissance flights over the United States, which the Americans were totally unable to stop, and they launched ultimately thousands of balloon bombs, which set the Pacific Northwest aflame. Now, people would say, how could they get 120,000 I-Cubs across the Pacific and generate 100,000 firestorms, and we not know about it in our history?
Well, yeah, I have heard about it. There has been fires from there. It's not really talked about a lot, but it's kind of downplayed from what your numbers are. But some have gotten through history.
Yeah, but it's always enough of the – they only tell you enough of the truth to uphold the lie.
Right.
And to put this into perspective for you, to modern Americans who can't fathom how the U.S. government hit a Japanese-conducted domestic bombing campaign from the American public through 4.5 years of proactive conflict, they advertise their ignorance of the fact – and it's no fault of their own. It's government-imposed. They advertise their ignorance of the fact that in 1939 – the same year that war erupted once again in Central Europe, the United States government admitted that 503 million acres of land remained totally uncharted in the United States. And even today, 383 million acres of Western federal land have never been surveyed, ever. That's 17% of the entire United States. And another 50 million acres, 2.2% of the USA, were last surveyed, quite inadequately, over a century ago. And the 1990 census counted 143 counties in 15 western states with two or less people living in every square mile. That's 572,000 people in an area of 950,000 square miles. That's another 25% of the nation. We know practically nothing about 20% of the western states of our own nation, and another 25% is so sparsely populated that it's virtually uninhabited. This is over half the United States. A federally owned and altogether habitably isolated mystery on the American map. If you're not poaching or prospecting, you're not even going to know what's going on out there. To put it in perspective, 5% of the American land east of the geographic center line of the USA is owned by the federal government. West of that U.S. center line, over 50% is federal property. Legally defined as frontier until the outbreak of World War I.
All right, well, hold on there. We'll take a break, and we'll come right back as we continue. Are you getting your greens? I'm James Othiancic, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. In today's busy world, greens often consist of the lettuce on a fast food hamburger. And even people who are health conscious and drink high quality pre or post workout protein shakes miss their greens all the same. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Inner Food by Inner Health Botanicals. Inner Food promotes health and boosts energy with nature's finest superfoods. Inner Food is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Inner Foods helps you fight an acidic body pH, which has been shown to lead to poor health and even cancer. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Inner Food is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, feedtofire.com, and click on any Enter Health Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Enter Food, building health from the insides out. Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organic seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A 1 pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed 2 people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of 4. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed 8 people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll-free in the United States and Canada at...
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
Have internet access. Point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f at innersights.com. That's f2f at innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Jancic.
Well, this will wake you up. We are talking with Douglas Dietrich as he's going through and giving us the history of Roswell. Now, it's very intertwined and intertwined with World War II. We've had a show on that. We've had a show on the Satanism. They're all kind of intertwined. So we are going to be weaving in and out as we continue because, of course, there's a lot of people listening, of course, have not heard the other shows, which I highly recommend for a greater understanding of it. And what we are talking about today is Roswell, the real story behind it, and how it relates to all these things will be apparent as we continue with Douglas Dietrich. And welcome back, Douglas.
Yes, thank you. And please be patient because it all intertwines, and that's the reality of history. If you're given the simple short story by these people like Stanton Friedman, who says, yeah, it's two spacecraft that crashed into each other, and that's literally what he says. And he says it repeatedly. He says it so often, he could say it in his sleep. He's been saying the same thing for 20 years, and no one's taken him out. So obviously, what he's saying isn't true. But beyond that, the sheer absurdity of what he's saying shows the utter contempt that he has for you as an audience. Because he says, two craft came from light years away so they could play a game of chicken and crash into each other over the planet Earth. I mean, it's preposterous. It's beyond offensive, but it's carried out, and then he carries with it that if you don't believe it, you're not a patriot because the 509th Bomber Group backs him up. And I'll tell you why in just a minute. The 509th Bomber Group, as well as every other bomber group in the United States, had their asses kicked by the jet stream. That current of air that brought all those ICUBs, those unguided missiles over, those 30-foot span balloon bombs over to the United States, basically were riding winds that the Japanese knew about, and they were reputed at 25,000 feet to be about 60 miles per hour. And then when B-29s started trying to bomb Japan, they started hitting these winds that were 175 miles an hour at 30,000 feet. This forced them all to hit the floor and bomb Japan. And because of that, they were exposed to Japanese anti-aircraft fire at a murderous rate, and less out of 5,000 of them that were downed over Japan. These were just the ones that were downed over Japan, period. And there were many more downed in other areas of the Pacific. But the ones over the Japanese home islands, out of the 5,000 bombardiers that were able to parachute on Japan, of course, the Japanese tore them apart physically as soon as they landed on the ground. And less than 80 of them survived who were lucky enough to get caught by Japanese police or military for interrogation. So the Americans became aware of this. They knew the danger of it. They knew there was no way to stop it. That's one of the reasons why they invested in HAARP. One of its primary functions is to be able to reverse the jet stream. And so that's why it's sitting up in Gokona, Alaska. So if they ever go to war with Japan again, they can reverse the jet stream. That's the whole intent. So in terms of this idea that the 509th Bomber Group was the first bomber group, like they keep telling you, again, this is part of that whole skein of lies that they're telling you in order to preserve a reputation. The reality was that the Japanese had started working on the atomic bomb long after, as soon as Einstein came up with the equations, because every physicist in the world knew that those equations would unleash a tremendous amount of energy. The Americans, however, had, as a scientific advisor to Roosevelt, Enrico Fermi, who was so conservative, he said it would take 100 years to build a bomb. And the Japanese didn't think so. They went to work on it right away. They built what were known as Ki-77s that were based on a original kind of plane that was had a different designation to build a bomber wing. This was in the 1920s and the 1930s. And its whole point, these were known as Mitsubishi Ki-20s. They were redirects or clones of Junkers K-51s. They were so big that the Germans only built two of them, and the Japanese built six of them. That was their version of a 509th bomber wing. It was used as strategic deterrence against the Soviet Union throughout the Second World War, and it was only pulled out of Manchuria at the last part of the war to redirect its deterrence, and the Americans will never speak about this. So it's just another hidden part of history, and it's so important to bring this up so that people get a perspective of how much they're being lied to. But in terms of the Battle of Los Angeles, where these dirigibles were first applied, we're talking about February 24th through February 25th of 1942. And these dirigibles are basically enormous. They're about 1,000 feet in diameter. They're 800-foot balloons that are surrounding a single 200 or 300 diameter foot diameter balloon. And so you've got a total of 9 balloons that are contained within a giant shell to hold in nothing more than air and give it the aerodynamic kind of shape that it has, which looks like a giant, what the Americans called later on, flying hamburgers. And this super dirigible system had, of course, a lot of hollow pockets in between these balloons. That was all air, but inside of them was hydrogen gas. Now, the Americans had a monopoly on helium, and the Americans used this after World War I to design flying aircraft carriers. And this is why you find naval bases that have enormous hangars that are out in the middle of landlocked areas like Kansas. And so the Americans developed the Macon, the Akron, and the Shenandoah. And these had catapulted biplanes that were underslung them so that they could fly out to sea from the middle of the United States and never get bombed by enemy fire. And they would unleash their planes to basically attack ships over at sea. The Japanese saw this was a great idea. And they sabotaged the program because the Navy was infested and saturated, would be a better word, with Filipino stewards. It became infested with Japanese spies. And as a result, they would sabotage the rudders and various implements on these flying aircraft carriers. They sent the entire program crashing down in flames, Hindenburg style. So that's how the Macon, the Akron, and the Shenandoah met their deaths, all violently. All of this can be confirmed. Anybody can look this up and find out the fact that America's flying aircraft carrier program went down in flames. This left the Japanese in total dominance of that kind of technology. They pursued it. They perfected it. And over the Battle of Los Angeles, they basically flew over Los Angeles. And in one sense, it was a failure. But in another sense, it was a tremendous success. And on the night of the Battle of Los Angeles, radar spotted 25 planes at 12,000 over Los Angeles. And then a balloon was spotted. Everybody was talking about how slow-moving these various craft were, how beautiful they were. They looked like giant Chinese lanterns. Their illustrations can be found on my Facebook if you just hit the storyboard area for the portfolios, what's known as the display bar or the banner. And you can peruse through examples of this. But the whole point about this was that they had parasite fighters that they unleashed over the city of Los Angeles to act as basically distraction for the anti-aircraft guns. And the anti-aircraft guns fired in Los Angeles about 1,500 rounds of ammunition at least. Some of these hydrogen balloons got punctured. They just discharged them over the sea. You could lose two, three of these balloons, and the balloons would, the entire integral aircraft would still stay aloft. And the air raid wardens all confirmed that planes had actually been shot down. The headlines the very next day said that planes were shot down at 185th Street and Vermont Avenue. They even gave addresses where these planes were shot down. Later on, there was a young paper boy who called up basically Dan Tryon of Redding, California. This was back when I used to listen to KGO News Talk in San Francisco, and KGO News Talk had a million people call in and write letters about the Battle of Los Angeles. And one of them was Dan Tryon, who had picked up a piece of bloody parachute harness, and he saw a newly wrecked plane at Mines Field, M-I-N-E-S, Mines Field in California, which was Japanese. And he says, oh, God, look, they shot down a Japanese plane. He went back the next day for more debris, and all of it was gone. So they were already developing a protocol for just hiding everything and then explaining all of their losses as basically aliens from Mars. And that way they could continue to refer to the Japanese the way they had always referred to them, enemy aliens, and get people confused as the extraterrestrials. And to show you what a great success this was for the Japanese in terms of the Battle of Los Angeles, by just floating in the sky over Los Angeles and not doing anything, they managed to take entire divisions out of the war and prolong the war by years. And the way that they were able to do this was because the Japanese knew that the Americans had basically invested everything in the war in Europe because their racism said, oh, the Germans are a bigger threat. They're white. They're Caucasian. We've got to concentrate on them first. So in all of World War II, only 15% of all resources in America went to the Pacific theater. And of that, one-third went to fight the Japanese in Alaska, where they had occupied the Aleutian Islands to prevent the Americans from bombing Japan from out of the Aleutian Islands. And so what had happened was that years before, Emperor Hirohito had dispatched Hideo Noguchi, who was a celebrity spy. He was the Michio Kaku of his day. And he had managed to isolate polio, rabies, syphilis, trachoma, and yellow fever. He was famous biological labs the world over. You know, that's a really astonishing tally for a single biologist, by the way. Turned out he didn't isolate any of these things. He was just lying. And that way he got samples of all of these bacterial vials from American labs and would bring them back home for Emperor Hirohito, the biologist, to weaponize. Now, Noguchi died of yellow fever. So he died around, he died when Hirohito was about 27 years old. And so Hirohito, by that time, had gotten all of the biologicals he needed, the last one being yellow fever, to commence weaponization. And because Hideo Noguchi had died of yellow fever, the Americans responded after the Battle of Los Angeles. They said the Japanese didn't drop any bombs, so they must have aerosolized biocidals and sprayed them over Los Angeles. That entire city is going to be infected. So they made the decision to write off Los Angeles and cordon it off and let everybody inside die and make sure nobody escaped. So they inoculated a bunch of troops with the yellow fever vaccine in early 1942. And keep in mind, this was just right after the Battle of Los Angeles and direct response to it. And so when they inoculated them with this vaccine, which had never been approved or licensed by the FDA, it turned out that it had all kinds of diseases in it from all the cadavers and aborted fetuses that they had used to make for the human serum components of the vaccine. And a whole bunch of men died. As a matter of fact, 51,000 military personnel came down with various gradations of hepatitis that were to prove fatal. And overall, about 350,000 military personnel were infected over the next several decades, enough to take them out of military service immediately. But 51,000 died. Now, this entire division that were taken out of the Pacific theater and prolonged the war by years. And again, this puts it into perspective for you, the kind of power that these dirigibles had and why the American government wanted to hide anything about them. So when the American government dropped the atomic bomb on August of 1945, Hirohito dispatched three of these to the United States to force the Americans in the ceasefire. He had about a dozen left in the mainland area of China, where Japan had enormous holdings and still retained total control. And the Americans hadn't made a dent. And effectively speaking, the Japanese were even still doing offensives in 1945, wiping out American air bases and their ability to support any effort for a war in China. So with all of these dirigibles still left in China, he had enough to finish America off with the biologicals that he had perfected. And he had perfected them to a degree where he could have wiped out the majority of the American public. And by forcing the Americans into ceasefire, he forced them to open up their markets, which brought Japan into the prosperity that it enjoyed till it divested in America about the time that I exposed the Roswell debris anonymously. And so when these dirigibles arrived, it was basically on the same day as the Nagasaki bombing, and it was too late to stop that. But so they arrived in the United States and forced a ceasefire on essentially. They were launched on August 6th and reached the United States on August 9th. And keep in mind, there's always one day ahead for Japan because they're on the other side of the international dateline. But when they came to the United States, they landed at Tonopah Army Airfield. The reason why was because that was where America had developed its jet fighters. It had developed only four of them. They were all stranded across the Atlantic. They were unable to deploy them against these dirigibles. And so the Americans took the crews hostage. They were known as aeronauts. And they basically started torturing them for the next several years, trying to force them to show the Americans how to use these weapons. These aeronauts were very special people in a number of ways. Just as the Americans had mobilized all of La Cosa Nostra and their mafia, such as Lucky Luciano, to find out intelligence before their invasion of Sicily and then the Italian peninsula, and they had mobilized the local mafias to fight against German saboteurs or trade unionists on the docks of the East Coast. So the Japanese had mobilized their own mafia known as the Yakuza, the samurai mafia, and these were extremely impoverished people. The average Japanese soldier was 5 feet tall. They were a race of vegetarians. This is one of the reasons why American and British and Caucasian prisoners of war died at 7 times the rate in Japanese prisoner of war camps that they died in Nazi prisoner of war camps, was because the Japanese fed off on the field what any Caucasian would consider to be bait, leavings, and mulch. And to give half of that rations, which is what you traditionally give prisoners of war, half of what your troops eat in the field, to give half of that to a Caucasian, especially an American raised on beef, he usually starved to death within days, which is what most of these prisoners of war did. Well, these Japanese were even shorter than the average Japanese soldier, 4 feet tall. And as Yakuza, they went through the cultic initiation rituals of cutting off their pinkies. This was done every time they advanced in rank. So by the time you're a full-fledged Yakuza member, you have 4 fingers on each hand, 3 fingers and 1 thumb. So these controls within these craft were made for people who were 4 feet tall with 4 fingers each. There was no way a Caucasian could even fit in these vehicles in their cockpits to fly them. So the only recourse they had was to continue to torture the Japanese crews and make them fly them. And to put this into perspective for people, because people just don't get the atrocity that we're dealing with, at the end of World War II, the Americans had 425,000 German prisoners of war, 53,000 Italian prisoners of war, and basically 5,000 Japanese, 5,000 Koreans, and 5,000 Taiwanese prisoners of war. And people have to remember, Japan was a multi-ethnic nation. It had Korean units, had Taiwanese units, and had Okinawan units, just in the same sense that the British Empire had Irish guards, Welsh guards, Scots guards, and various other units that they deployed all over the world. So that's how they wound up with all these cross-Asian prisoners, and they didn't even know their difference in their races. And these camps, especially the ones in California, Fort Tracy, Camp Cochrane, Camp Bakersfield, Camp Lamont, they all opened in 1945. There was no such thing as a Japanese prisoner of war camp until that period of time. They were all here after the war. All the Germans and Italians I just mentioned, they were all used for slave labor, and they couldn't let them go for decades. Some of them stayed here for like at least half a decade, some of them for a full decade, because they were forced to pick fruit in the fields, what we have illegal immigrants do today. We never had illegal immigrants back in those days, so they used Axis prisoners of war. So the farm lobby kept saying to the government, we can't let these boys go. They're a vital part of our economy. As a result, you had Jesse Marceau Jr. in Roswell, New Mexico, claim, yeah, I saw Deutsche Afrika Korps prisoners of war walking all around Roswell doing the scut work. Well, you can imagine what they did to the Japanese prisoners of war. Well, guess what? They never went home. And this is one of those reasons why the Asians have never let American prisoners of war loose from the Korean War or the Vietnam War, because they figured, look at how they treated Asian prisoners of war. Why should we treat them any better? They never let those boys go home. Why should we let these guys go home?
Now, let me stop it for a second. One thing that comes to mind is how I look at the way things are run in government. I mean, your own job is proof of it, is it's very incompetent. And yet, yeah, it seems that they were quite competent and able to put a lid on a very large thing for a very long time.
You can't do so without the help of the victim. At some point, when you're a victimizer, this is where, see, I majored in criminology when I was young. I went to City College, I studied criminology, and that was how I was able to take a lot of the photos that I put in the DVD, Satan's Crusaders. I took a lot of photos with this little German miniature camera that you used to see in all the old spy movies that used to unfold and you'd see the lens. I got that training from criminology department at City College of San Francisco. One of the things I majored in was criminal psychology. And in criminal psychology, one of the first things you notice is that many of these villains, these serial killers, these serial rapists, they get away with what they do because they have cooperation from their first set of victims, which is their family. That's why so many of them are married and have kids. And at some point, a lot of these child molester types, they have children who they train to bring home other kids as friends and playmates from school that they can molest. And these children are in such fear and such brainwashing, they wind up becoming abusers, co-abusers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then when the parents get arrested and taken away, they grow up, and oftentimes, tragically, they follow the same cycle. That's exactly what happened with the entire Roswell community. The entire Roswell community was terrorized right after the Roswell incident. The first person to run across the debris field was Billy Mac Brazel, as they referred to him in the documents. They kept calling him Billy Mac. And William Mac Brazel ran into the debris field, and the first thing he said, this was his actual quote, was when he looked at all of the calligraphy and the symbology on all of the balloon debris, he said, "Japanese or Chinese." That was his words. They took him and they beat him to within an inch of his life for a full week. And when he came out, he was ashen gray, wouldn't look anybody in the eye.
Now, how do you know about this event, that he got beaten and so on?
He himself spoke of being beaten.
Okay.
that was nothing that was his.
All right, I'm just asking. You know, I'm asking.
Yeah,
I'm participating,
yeah, but
listeners.
That I know of from the documents myself, but my documents aren't enough. You have to take a look at what I saw and compare it to history that is out there that people can verify. And that is something you can verify. Billy Mac Brazel was very much terrorized. And he came out and he wouldn't talk to anybody about it again. And you had people, and the people of Roswell themselves will say this, that parents were taken away from the children by the military and told, if you talk, we're going to kill your children. Children were taken away by the military and told, if you talk, we're going to kill your parents. And anybody who survived that incident from that period of time will tell you this. And they were all witnesses, because Billy Mac Brazel, the day that the Japanese vented all the hydrogen cells in a super dirigible and blew their super dirigible up in midair, it was so loud that it was heard through a raging thunderstorm, which is what they were taking advantage of to self-immolate. And they were boxed in. Keep in mind, this is what happened, was the Navy had been in a tremendous budget battle with the Army. There was no such thing in the United States as an Air Force. And the United States Army Air Corps was desperate to start an Air Force. If they got that going, them and all the physicists could cooperate in a multi-billion-dollar budget black hole that would have no oversight, because the Air Force has never had oversight with its black budget for national security reasons. And they figured that we have to beat the Navy in this budget battle. Well, what happened was, in December of 1946, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal launched Operation High Jump, which was supposed to be the last great battle of the Atlantic, where they were going to face the Nazis in Antarctica and take them out. Whoever doesn't believe this, that's a whole question entirely, because we'll do a whole other program on it to clarify that. But the end result was the Navy failed in Operation High Jump. And so you wound up with thousands of Marines dying. They always talk about those few sailors who died flying those PBYs. That's the same kind of PBYs that got shot down out of the sky throughout the war in the Aleutians against the Japanese. And the Navy deployed these in the Antarctica. A few of them got blown out of the sky. They never talk about the thousands of Marines who died down there. And with that tremendous failure, because the Marines are a subsidiary, they're the naval infantry, with that tremendous failure, it got turned over to the Army. And only 3 months after the Operation High Jump debacle, the Army says, let's test this big atomic bomb, see if this atomic bomb can be carried on this parasite bomber underslung this Japanese dirigible system. And that's what it was. These Japanese super dirigibles were able to carry an enormous number of craft as flying aircraft carriers. They carried what were not technically fighters, but rather attack planes that were parasite craft that were actually hung up on the inside of that massive outer shell of the, which was nothing more than a big shell of rubberized silk. And this rubberized silk was covering these eight separate balloons surrounding a central balloon system. So there was plenty of space to hang the parasite fighters up like Peking ducks on racks. These parasite fighters were Zimmers, or Zimmerman skimmers. They were designed by a gentleman known as Zimmerman. The plans were actually either stolen by the Japanese, or he sold them to the Japanese when the Americans refused to buy his plans. It was never clear. But Americans sold plans to the Japanese all the time. Like Desversky sold his Desversky fighters to the Japanese. They wound up coming back at the Americans under Japanese roundels. appropriately. They were codenamed Dicks. But anyhow, we'll get back to the Roswell incident after this break, which I assume is upon us.
Yes, it is coming, and time is flying already. We're already half through the interview. Can you imagine it? You know, I'm just going along for the ride here because Douglas has got a very well coherent, put together way to go through this, and I'll just toss in things along the way. And we'll be back to continue in this pre-recorded segment of Feet to the Fire with Douglas Dietrich talking about what really happened in Roswell. And we'll be right back. Gravity-fed water filters. That is the magic word for guaranteeing you pure fresh water regardless of what happens. You can find a river, stream, some source, any source of water. These filters will make them pure as the driven snow. Berkey's been a big name in filters for a long time, and we've had many sponsors to sell Berkey filters all over the years. And we have a new relationship with GetBerkey.com, and let me tell you why. Because not only do they have an excellent supply of British Berkfield, as well as the American Berkey, but they also sell an array of filters that are the ceramic variety, you know, the ones that James McKinney has mentioned and recommended. So now you can go to GetBerkey.com and custom build the perfect system for you, a stainless steel, the plastic, the British Berkfield, the Berkey, the ceramic, the typical black filters. You know, there were some problems a while ago with the black filters. I had some that leaked as well. But that has all been fixed, and I'm confident they're okay. But since then, people have kind of went to the ceramic filters, like Dalton. And so I really appreciate people at Get Berkey for putting together all these systems to let you choose. No one's forcing you to take any particular brand or variety. They'll educate you on the website about what is what and how to do to combine them. So what you need to do is go to our website and click through on our links to Get Berkey. That's Berkey, the British Berkfield, and the Dalton filters, all there, the ceramic as well as the black filters. GetBerkey.com, and tell them Beat the Fire sent you. So click through on our links to Get Berkey, and you will get Berkey. Also, for Feet to Fire listeners, people at Get Berkey has put together a coupon for 5% off your purchase. 5% off your purchase. Just put in F2F. That's a digit 2, F2F, as a coupon code to get an additional 5% off. And, of course, orders over $25 are free shipping. So there you go. Get Berkey and Feet to Fire. What a team.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at...
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@intersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
Well, somebody is not telling the truth. How many times have we had that on this show and others where you have history, tradition, religion, all these things, science even, where when you start to actually bring out a different perspective with the information and data and they arrange it in such a way as to break the illusions, one has to make a decision. What is the deal here? And Douglas has been giving us a rundown, a lead up, and going into what really happened at the Roswell crash with a lot of data. And again, his DVD that is available has a lot of pictures and diagrams and whatnot, and much more data, I guess, than we'll get into here because it's got a wider range that you can pick up from his website. And those are still available, aren't they, or no?
Yes, sir. Yeah, okay. We're going to be selling them until the supplies run out, and because we will be releasing them in book form in the UFOCon. So we felt that it's best to just run out this set of DVDs while we have them, and then we won't we have no plans to produce another set at least for the foreseeable future, because we want people to buy the book. And the book, of course, will be easily accessible illustrations. Going to have all the illustrations that are in the DVD plus many more. That will be appended. But the beauty of the DVD is that at least you get to see the live lecture. And what makes it so poignant and so important is that, in a very real sense, it's a celebration of respect for my mother's death, because she died as a direct result of that presentation, which is recorded on that DVD. And I have no doubt of that. Her death was just too strange, artificially induced, most certainly, by the diagnosis of the doctors themselves. They'd never seen anything like it. And so the end result, again, to get back to what we're talking about with the super dirigibles and the technology of them, was that you have not only the Peking duck rack, so to speak, surrounding the circular frame of the dirigible itself. These balloons were so huge, they had the ability to lift only not only their own weight, but also close to 300 tons of weight altogether, I believe. I'm not an engineer, but that was the impression that I've got while I've been doing some engineering archaeology with people who have been looking at the diagrams that I was able to trace, which I show in the DVD Roswell and the Rising Sun, which is available through my website at douglasdietrich.com. But in terms of the frame of the dirigible, it was more than just rubberized silk. It, of course, had a kind of girder system, if you will, of cranes. If you've ever seen a building crane and how that link, that crook, overhangs the pulley, which lifts things at various construction sites, these didn't have any pulley system, but they were kind of like very light skeletal cranes, about eight of them, that would link in a very primitive clasping fashion to a containment box in the center. That containment box was a circular or octagonal hollow containment box that always universally carried bomb bays to drop biocidals, but could also be used to carry inverted racks, which launched Oka-piloted bombs. And that's so important because that's a large part of the big lie that the United States perpetrated in terms of claiming that it broke the sound barrier as just part of that deal to get American enthusiasm up to fund a U.S. Air Force. I mean, we all remember that 1947 was the year that, good God, what was his name? Since I'm so familiar with all the foreign intelligence that I dealt with, I tend to forget his name. But the man who broke the sound barrier, sir, was, if you could help me with that, Chuck Yeager.
Well, yes, yeah,
Chuck Yeager.
Yeah, there we go.
In his Bell X-1, the glamorous Glennis, which was attached to a B-50 mothership, was supposed to be the first man to break the sound barrier. That's an absolute lie. The Oka-piloted bombs were rockets. And so they're piloted rockets. And the Japanese used this to break the sound barrier multiple times, because that was part of the destructive capacity. When these things went into make contact with ships, they would disintegrate before contact with the ship, and the very breaking of the sound barrier would create an enormous amount of damage to the ship's infrastructure. This is why the whole kamikaze phenomena, no one heard about it till after World War II. If anyone claims they heard about it on the American home front, they're not telling the truth, because GIs were ordered in the Pacific never to write home about this on pain of death, because they didn't want to create a panic back home at the damage that the kamikaze were causing. So these kamikaze Oka piloted bombs, known as Baka to the Americans, B-A-K-A, but the Japanese name was O-H-K-A, Oka piloted bombs. They basically broke the sound barrier, disrupted a ship's infrastructure, deafened everybody that was on the deck, ruptured their eardrums, truly terrifying weapons. One of these dirigibles could carry about 20 of them in inverted racks that would be launched from the dirigible, along with its bomb bays, along with they would have in other setups inverted 88s that would pound Chinese cities into rubble. None of this fancy stuff was used over America. They were only going to drop biocidal bombs, unleash their bombers, which wouldn't have used a drop of fuel to cross the Pacific, so they'd have a full fuel load to cross the entire American continent and unleash their biocidal bombs. They had the parasite fighters, which would each carry one biocidal bomb that would extend their range of dropping biocidals all over the United States. They could have pretty much wiped out the American public with this, and that was the threat that forced the Americans into ceasefire. So the Americans were never going to talk about this. They called it topological space collapse. They had no ability to defend against this because their war was all offensive. They had fielded a football team that was all offense and no defense. So then what happens is they've dehumanized the Japanese to the point where nobody even recognizes them as human beings. And people find that extremely hard to believe in this day and age, because we see people of different ethnicities everywhere, and we don't remember the kind of racism that was experienced in World War II. When you look back on the American internment of 120,000 Japanese civilians, they all instantly were re-registered. Their citizenship deprived, they were re-registered as illegal enemy aliens. Now, for years after the war, my mother was an enemy alien, and she wasn't even an American at the time, because all these GIs who were in Korea and Japan and Vietnam were all trying to marry these Asian brides, and the UCMJ, Uniform Code of Military Justice, says you cannot marry them because they might be a spy, we can't tell them apart, so they blanketed them all as enemy aliens, and any GI who married them would go to jail for marrying a foreign intelligence agent. And so as a result, all kinds of people were committing lover suicides. So Marlon Brando was even part of a movie titled Sayonara, in which they outlined this whole phenomena and brought it to the public attention. My father was part of a class action lawsuit of thousands of enlisted men and officers who sued the U.S. military, went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which overturned the UCMJ as unconstitutional. And then in 1951, you could marry an Asian Pacific Islander and not have her declared as an enemy alien. And my father met my mother in 1945, was unable to marry her until 1951, when the Japanese-Americans signed a peace treaty, when the Japanese and the Americans signed a peace treaty, and then after that, she was no longer an enemy alien. But until that time, going back to the time of the 1920s, when they had the Alien Exclusion Act, basically they declared that Americans of African descent could be considered citizens, Americans of Caucasian descent could be, but all Asians, by the 1920 Exclusion Act, were considered enemy aliens. And people don't realize that level of racism that went on at that time. And I try to present to people, look, you're talking about a period of time up to the 1970s, when you had people like, David Carradine playing Kung Fu, which was the role that was meant for Bruce Lee, because nobody would accept Bruce Lee because he looked too ethnic. Everybody wanted a white-looking guy, and so they had David Carradine play him. You had, Christopher Lee play Fu Manchu. You had Audrey Hepburn played a Chinese woman in The Good Earth. You had a Yugoslav man named Peter Lorre play Mr. Mato, the Japanese detective. I mean, there was no Asian playing Asian roles. It's like people wearing blackface. Nobody knew what an Asian looked like. And when they really saw Asians, to them, they truly looked alien. And for people to comprehend that in this day and age, you're talking about you know, to show you how racist the Americans were, Life magazine showed a picture of a woman named Natalie Richardson in Phoenix, Arizona, who had been given a skull by her boyfriend, who was in the Navy, and his entire unit had autographed this Japanese skull, which they sent back to her as a paperweight. She was just one amongst thousands of people who were getting this. UC Berkeley today, and I still retain photos, which I put in Roswell and the Rising Sun, of the catalog cards. UC Berkeley today had whole boxes of Japanese bones that were sent back to them from the Pacific of Japanese women and children that the GIs had killed, and they listed them anthropologically as subhuman primates, and they're all kept at UC Berkeley in these anthropological boxes, and they got a lot of flack for it, and I don't think nearly enough. This is the kind of racism that we're dealing with. They did not think of the Japanese as human. Life magazine said in its officially vetted government article that every Japanese man, woman, and child must be destroyed. They said that in June 11th of 1945, total war calls for total defeat. That means that the war-making capacity of every Japanese resource, every Japanese man, woman, and child must be destroyed. And they kept listing them as inhuman enemies, aliens, illegal enemy aliens, again and again. This is an official representation of them. And so with this kind of dehumanization going on, it didn't make any sense to people, even though when they were referring to them as prisoners. But anyhow, so the Japanese were over the Roswell area. You've got a very strange setup where you've got the lowest education levels in the United States. That's what it was chosen for. You have literally the lowest education of the American population was in New Mexico. They brought the highest educated populace over there, the scientists, to test weapons in the Four Corners area and to test unconventional as well as nuclear weapons. And then you finally had a setup where they said, well, now we can convince everybody that in the budget, the people who count it, the Senate oversight hearing committees, that we can beat the Nazis in Antarctica if we can deploy this atomic bomb using this super dirigible. So what they did in their, and this is where some of the incompetence comes in, to make sure that this dirigible wouldn't be seen by the populace, they did conducted the overflight at night. And to make it reflect in the moonlight so they wouldn't lose visual contact with it, they repainted it all in the same highly inflammable silver nylon paint that covered the Hindenburg. And the Hindenburg's crash was caused by static electricity. You can rub your hands together over a shag carpet, touch a doorknob, and you get 30,000 volts that run through you. And it goes through you so fast that it doesn't kill you. But the Japanese were well aware of the dangers of static electricity in the atmosphere, so all of their trained aeronauts had always completely shaven bodies, even while prisoners. So even the crotch hair would be shaved. The only body hair they would leave on themselves would be their eyelashes. Now, they were all being tortured because they were Yakuza. Their entire bodies were covered in tattoos. And the interrogations that I read in those files said that they continually skinned their tattoos off of them to force them into action and doing what the Americans demanded. Well, during the time of the Roswell incident, you've got what would normally be an asbestos-covered, rubberized silk material. This is why it was so hard to burn for the residents of Roswell. You have it covered in this highly inflammable nylon silver paint, the same thing that set the Hindenburg aflame, because what happened was they cast down their mooring line, the static electricity went up and set the Hindenburg aflame. The Kapitan of the Hindenburg told everybody, stay with me and you'll live. If you jump, you're going to die, because we're going to go down slow because this thing's so huge. Now, everybody who followed his orders lived. That's why more people survived the Hindenburg than died. But everybody who jumped died. Now, it was the same way with the Japanese. That's why you still had prisoners left over after this super dirigible inferno. And, well, it was a night that was stormy, and in those areas, it started off as a moonlit night and then suddenly went stormy. And in those areas, a storm will come out of nowhere. The Japanese took advantage of it. There were all kinds of flares the Americans had never been able to access because they couldn't fit in the vehicles. And the Japanese vented all the hydrogen gas cells, immolated themselves. It blew, and when it blew, it was so loud that Billy McGrazel heard it the night that it blew, and he had 600 audio witnesses beside him. That's why the entire community...
That's a lot of hydrogen. That's a lot of hydrogen, and it makes a lot of noise.
Yeah, and
so the rocket engine is hydrogen and oxygen combining, and it can hear it for 30 miles.
Yes, yes, and that's why those residents were so terrorized by the U.S. military into not talking, and later on they became dependent on that whole Roswell myth for their economy, and then became co-abusers, and that was exactly the way Aquino engineered it. Aquino had told me, he says, the way I did my greatest PSYOP operation against the American people, and he was always laughing his ass off about this. He said, we've taken surveys on it. And later on, there was even a civilian. His name was Frank Borzolini, and he wrote a book called Who Believes in Roswell? I mean, the very title itself really ought to tell you something. It's not who knows about Roswell or who knows what facts about Roswell. It was who believes in Roswell, like it's a religion. And this was his master's thesis at Fordham University, and he had responses from over 1,000 people, and it went all the way down the line evenly. There was no gray area. It was just pure black and white. It was just basically, if you're over 65, you're the most likely to believe. If you're 50 to 64, a little less likely. 30 to 49, you're not going to believe. Under 14, you're pretty skeptical about it. But basically, it was consistent along the board. The older you are, the more you believe. Politically, it was all the same. Depending on your religiosity, the more conservative you were going to believe. The more liberal you were, the less likely you were to believe. The less educated you were, the more you were to believe. And remember, the pre-World War II generation was the least educated generation we've ever had. It was after World War II we had the GI Bill, and suddenly everybody got educated. Before the GI Bill, education was a luxury. Only the rich got educated. And so before World War II, you had a very uneducated, religious public. And again, this is how it divides. If you're atheistic or agnostic, you're not going to believe in Roswell. Least likely to believe if you're more liberal, more progressive. The more your degree of religiosity, the more conservative you are, the more likely you are to believe. And so the whole reason for this is not only age and education, and the more college you have, and everything differentiating this, it's basically who was ever raised to believe what Uncle Sam told them. That's what it all came down to. And that's what our friend Colonel Aquino was working with. He said, the funniest thing of all is I got all these Christians to believe in an alien religion. He said, I created a phony religion in which, he made this comparison with Japan. He said, the Japanese, they're 2,600 years old. They're almost 3,000 years old. They have this belief in the kami and the Shinto way of their gods coming down to earth and creating their race. The Americans are less than 200 years old. They've got nothing like it. He said, I'm going to give them their Promethean religion. I'm going to give them their Hercules coming down from the sky to touch them, and they're going to worship this. I'm going to create a new lourdes, a new Medjugorje for them to make pilgrimage to. And I made thousands of these Christians believe in little gray men. He says they're so stupid. They believe that they were made in God's image, and they believe these little gray runts with no genitalia are made in God's image too. He says that's how stupid they are. He was laughing all the way to the bank. And this was his greatest accomplishment. And he says, we've got everybody at Roswell who we terrorized in the U.S. Army. We even sent Hunter Penn, an Air Force hitman, to go around and terrorize entire families into the fact that they were going to die in a raging inferno at night while they were asleep if they didn't cooperate with us. Now they're cooperating, and it supports their school, supports their economy. Their entire economy floats on this. He says, this is the biggest joke I've ever played, and boy, are they the stupid suckers to buy into it. And this is why you've got Philip J. Corso, Lieutenant Colonel. This is why you've got Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall. This is why you've got all these guys coming up. Cameron Grant was just on public radio the other day, and he was talking about Senator Barry Goldwater approaching Curtis LeMay about the Roswell incident or UFOs. And Curtis LeMay went ape on him, just went ballistic, and said, don't you ever talk about that again. You're going to be court-martialed. And Cameron Grant tells the public to their eye, this is because they're aliens. I mean,
I do say one thing that does make sense here is, as I listen to this, is that I always often wondered why was it so people die, disappear, it's a black hole if you go past a certain point when it comes to the alien stuff. No, I had some things like, they don't want people to know there's another race out there or whatever. But to me, it makes more sense that they don't want people investigating in this because it would show what you're talking about.
Well, it does.
And it begs the question is like, well, you know, as you get this information out and you become more vocal on it, you know, are you going to expire?
Well, I'm a lot harder to kill than my mother was. And they know that for a fact. So in that sense, the best thing I can do to protect myself is to keep on talking.
And that's true. That's true. Yeah. Best thing to do is get it out there. But, I mean, it seems that unless there's so many things going on that take their attention now, and they are so messed up. I mean, I think of back in these days you were talking about, them being more capable, I don't know what you want to call it, of pulling something off, and nowadays it seems that it's fallen apart. I mean, look at Obama's birth certificate. I mean, it was like, you know, a joke, how they handled that. That could be the current mentality of the people, and it's like the emperors of Rome, as they got more inbred and decadent, they just became completely incompetent.
Absolutely. That's an excellent way of putting it. One of the things that I keep emphasizing is that there's no need to ever advocate or resort to violent revolution against this government because they're destroying themselves faster than you could ever hope to. And there's no point in trying to help them along because that'll just force them to galvanize and rally for just a little bit longer. Rather, just stand back and let them burn themselves out. Everything I saw in the government showed how incompetent they were, and that is to our favor. They're a sleeping giant that can never be awakened because it's suffering from narcolepsy, so it's permanently asleep, and it'll die asleep, but it can roll over and kill you in your sleep if you get too close. Mm. Now, I was very close, but at the same time, what I have to do now is get this out there and let you know the real dirty secret behind Roswell was the fact that they lost the war. That they were forced into years of talk-down negotiations from 1945, at time of ceasefire, to the time of the Presidio Military Base signing of the Japanese-American Peace Treaty in 1951, which opened American markets. Americans even turned over their aircraft carriers. Sailors had to fight and lobby to get aircraft carriers not to be turned over to Japan. We only have a few left that are floating museums. The rest, if you're driving a Toyota that was manufactured in the 1970s, guaranteed it's made out of an American aircraft carrier that got turned over to the Japanese as part of the booty of victory of war. And the Japanese said, everybody talks about, oh, yeah, well, the Japanese, they don't have war as part of their constitution. Well, their navy is the second largest in the world to the United States. And then they say, oh, yeah, they forswore war.
Oh,
forever.
You know, yeah, let's talk there for a minute. I looked up the navy sizes. They had a thing, and there was nothing listed for Japan. And I talked to you about this off the air, and you mentioned, yeah, because they call it, like, what was it, a Coast Guard or something like that? They renamed it so they don't have to count it?
Yes, that's right. It's called the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force, and it's technically a Coast Guard, but there's no Coast Guard in the world that has aircraft carriers other than the Japanese.
You see, that'd be cool. There's someone to start looking up for numbers on their military, and if that'll be able to be corroborated, and then you go, well, why aren't they calling it a Navy then? You see, that's a point where people can't ignore.
It's true. And beyond that, you can look up and you'll be unable to find the aircraft carriers because they're listed as super destroyers. That's it. You know, they're about the size of the Giuseppe Garibaldi of Italy. So Americans would say, oh, well, that's a helicopter carrier. Well, that's the kind of aircraft carrier that's made for a modern war.
Well, you know what? Let me interject again. I'm sorry. When they were the Russians moved these, what you're talking about, into the Mideast area. And it was downplayed by the press as being helicopter transport, you know, things. So they're using that excuse to play down that Russia has moved some aircraft carriers in the region.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And by the way, the Japanese, of course, in their war games with Westpac and the West Pacific war games every year, you know, they have these ships cross the Pacific and they visit ports in America and in South America. And there's no Coast Guard in the world that does that, you know, so it's an absurdity. But this is one of those things to put the American perspective on it, though. They used to have a Department of War. Well, the Japanese said, you better get rid of that Department of War. We never want you waging war again. We never want you declaring war again.
Okay. All right. Well, if I can go through this, what are we doing now? And what about Japan now with what's going on in the Mideast?
Well, Japan sends naval elements to aid the Americans at American request in logistics operations in the Middle East.
So they're on board with this then? Japan would be okay what's going on is what I'm saying?
Basically, it gives their men combat experience. But you'll notice that America has not declared a single war since the end of the Second World War. It never declared war again.
Yeah, that's another thing that's true. They've not. It's always been kind of action, you know.
And they got rid of the Department of War and replaced it with the Department of Defense.
All right. Well, let's take a break here. We're going to come back for the last hour as we go through talking with Douglas Dietrich about his evidence and outline portrayal of what really happened in Roswell, which touches into what happened in World War II and what is happening now. So hold on. And we'll be right back after this. You know, a lot of people worried about saving gold. You hear a lot of people buy gold. It's going to go up and down. Well, one thing about gold is it is a money. It's an arbitrary thing that is given value. And throughout history, it's been dependable. But we're entering a time in history that, well, things just aren't the same anymore. One thing you do need is food. Food, water, and some type of a shelter. We have the Berkey water filters. We have seeds, organic seeds to plant and so forth and so on. One thing you can stock up from is freeze-dried foods from eFoods Direct. We have links on the website, and click through to see it, and you can pick up a year's worth of food, 2 years, you know, 6 months, a weekend, a couple of weeks. You can store that, and it'll last for many, many years, dozens of years. And so that way you could keep it for long-term as well as use short-term. And so eFoods Direct, the new sponsor to Feet to Fire, click on the links on our website at feettofire.com and start putting together your food bank, if you will, in case of trouble ahead. Click on the links on our website at feettofire.com or give them a call at 800-876-0871 and make sure you tell them that you heard it on Feet to the Fire. I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio and creator and host of Feet to the Fire. Have you ever noticed the high volume of commercials on most talk shows? It is to the point that it seems like topics are the bait and the guests are the fillers to sell products. I've made a conscious decision to keep disruptions to a minimum and provide more uninterrupted time for the real reason you've tuned in. You hear guests with more time to make their points, allowing me and listeners to intuitively and intelligently formulate questions by having less interruptions to break the stream of consciousness. Feet to the Fire may be free to listen to, but it's not free to provide. We rely heavily on donations to offset the expenses of producing the show. If you like what we are doing and enjoy the show, why not consider donating via PayPal or a major credit card from our website, feettofire.com. Or write us at Feet to the Fire, P.O. Box 511, Minooka, Illinois, 60447. Thank you.
Every day there's someone asking, what is there to do? Should I love or should I fight? Is it all the same to you? No, I say I had the answer proven to be true. But if I were to share it with you, you would stand to gain and I'd lose. Oh, I couldn't bear it, so I've got to say, nothing to say, nothing to say. Every morning, pressure forming all around my fortune brought upon us, and I won't disguise them. don't even begin to tell you why. No, just because I have a name, well, I've got nothing to say.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at...
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
When we have a bunch of evidence like this, and the gauntlet is thrown down for someone to come out and refute what's going on here. I mean, if you're a listener and you want to arrange a time to talk about various topics, I'm game. If you are a professional in the area in Roswell, you want to talk about what Douglas is talking about, I'm game. My only request is that, you know, it's a discussion, not a debate. And I would referee it in that when a question is asked by one, the other one must respond. And not deflect. And, you know, you could say, I don't know. You could say, you know, I don't agree with that, and not put a case. You can, you know, there's ways you can respond. But that's why I'm not a big fan of debates. And I've had offered in the past people to come on, and the problem is it doesn't happen. Because if the person who's spinning things perceives they can't do spinning, then they're not going to be involved. And it'll be like, oh, the show's too small, or the show's too focused. I don't want to talk about this when you talk about that, or you have time's not convenient. It's too late in the, you know, they got all kinds of. She, oh, I'll be like, well, we'll tape, you know, we'll do it, and we'll have it on download then, and you can have it on your sites, and you can, you know, and of course, there's always another reason out of it. And a lot of people will give I'll give an interview if you just let me talk about what I talk about. Now, I'm not doing that here with Douglas. He may appear that way because I'm letting him talk a lot, but he's got such a good way of putting it out there. So I want him to get it out there. I want people to listen to it. I want people to come up with questions. And if you want, we'll have Douglas back to field them. Unfortunately, because of my having to leave town, I can't do that today. But is that okay with you, Douglas?
Of course. Yes, that goes without saying. I'd be happy to do that because... you know, so many of the people ask questions, and a lot of times it's based, unfortunately, on the fact that they don't want to hear this because it destroys an entire belief system. It's the equivalent of destroying a religion, which is exactly how the Satanic Colonel wanted it set up. And to give an example of this, a lot of the logic that comes from Stanton Friedman and all the rest of them, all of these embedded alien supporters who want you to believe it's extraterrestrials, that the 509th Bomber Group says it's extraterrestrials, one of the things that they keep throwing at you is 509th Bomber Group says it's extraterrestrials. They're the guys who dropped the atomic bomb to stop the war. Now, if you don't believe them, you don't believe they ended the war. And that means you're not a patriot. Well, are you saying that that atomic bomb didn't end the war? Then, of course, people say, no, I'm not saying that. Then I'm not unpatriotic. And so in the end, it's just shoved down their throat that if you don't believe this, the 509th Bomber Group, then you're not a patriot.
Yeah, you see, well, but you know, and we've talked a bunch of times off the air, even too. And you know, I don't allow that on the show. It's not like there's no emotion can be used in the rhetoric process. You have the evidence, the grammar, as it's called in the ancient tradition. You have the logic, and you arrange it in such a way as to eliminate contradiction. And then you articulate your findings. And if you just go to number three and say, well, I want to talk my way into what I want it to be, it's just not going to fly in the show.
Right. No, and I appreciate that. And, you know, to just kind of finish up that Roswell incident report, when the Japanese were in the super dirigible, we're talking about the super dirigible and the underslung bomber. The parasite fighters were not in it because the parasite fighters for that particular dirigible, since their pilots were the only ones who could fit in the cockpits, the Americans were torturing them, showing them a flight demonstration. They all broke loose and they headed towards Mexico. And that's when they were spotted by Kenneth Arnold. And because they were designed to be biomimetic and were dish-shaped, almost manta ray-shaped, these little parasite fighters were looked at by him as looking biological in nature. And at the time he reported it, the aviation pioneer Orville Wright automatically came out and right after Arnold's sighting, and he was really embittered by the Air Force and its propaganda. And he said right then and there that it's more propaganda for war to stir up the people, to excite them to believe a foreign power has designs on this nation. And that's from Orville Wright. And then the first Gallup poll was taken. A lot of people don't know this, but the city of Gallup, from whence the Gallup poll was taken, is in New Mexico. And this first Gallup poll on the flying saucer question was taken in August of 1947. Just 2 months after Arnold's sighting and just 1 month after the Roswell incident, and UFOs registered a phenomenal 90% awareness rate. This is the highest ever recorded for anything, before or since. And the U.S. Army considered itself having accomplished its mission of making everybody aware, saying it's a flying disc, retracting it, and then that's typical psyops. And then everybody believes it. And these are the kind of people, to show you how easily manipulated Americans are, to put this into perspective for you, on October 31st of 1941, just a few months before Pearl Harbor, the United States News, this was their version in those days of U.S. News and World Report, it was a national newspaper, the United States News carried a two-page story titled Bomber Lanes to Japan, Flying Times from Strategic Points, and it included a map depicting bases in Chongqing, Hong Kong, and Singapore. All British holdings, Cavite, Vladivostok, some Soviet holdings, Guam and Dutch Harbor, American holdings, and showing that American bombers would be launched to bomb Japan from these areas. And on November 15th of 1941, General Marshall, who disgustingly would be given a Nobel Peace Prize for his Marshall Plan, George Catlett Marshall, gave a briefing to the New York Times. This is November 15th, 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. He gave a briefing to the New York Times, the New York Tribune, Newsweek, and the Associated Press, saying the United States is going to start bombing operations against Japan in 10 days, the first 10 days of December. That's what he said. This was published in the newspapers, and then Pearl Harbor takes place, and nobody remembers any of this. So you talk to your average American who survived the entire World War, and you can interview 100% of them. I guarantee you, none of them will remember this consciously. And so people's brains and their minds and their memories can be switched so easily. And this is exactly what they were counting on to show you what kind of people the American U.S. Army Air Corps was. We know that they killed 600,000 Germans, 900,000 Japanese, 62,000 Italians through firebombing. What people don't know is they killed 24,000 Serbs who were their allies. And they did this because even though Serbia was allied to the United States and Croatia was allied to the Third Reich, Croatia was Vatican territory. And the Vatican paid the U.S. protection money to never bomb them, and then paid the U.S. Army Air Corps to bomb their Serbs, who were their enemy instead. And the U.S. Army Air Corps did it. I mean, as an example, and there's so much evidence of this, because what had happened was there was a guy called Richard Feldman, who I personally knew. He was a Jewish-American airman from Phoenix, Arizona, of all places. And during World War II, all of these GIs got shot down while bombing Romania. So the Serbs organized Operation Halyard because the Romanians were on the side of the Germans. So the Serbs infiltrated Romania, and they pulled the largest missing-in-action prisoner of war rescue operation in history, and they basically rescued 600, over half a thousand, American airmen. And they brought them all back, and you know what the Americans did in response? They bombed Serbia because they got money from the Vatican to do so. This is the kind of people that we're talking about, with that level of corruption, and the idea that they wouldn't lie to you about anything is absurd. Because on the day of the bombing of Nagasaki, they dropped the most powerful weapon in the American inventory, the plutonium bomb. And I spoke of this in one of our last conversations, specifically to destroy an underground manufacturing facility that was building Ki-77s, which is what the Americans called Patsy, long-range bombers that could go all the way from Tokyo to New York. And the Japanese were building them in the Mitsubishi plant underneath Nagasaki. They set off that plutonium bomb, and the 2,500 young ladies who were working in that plant had no idea that a plutonium bomb had gone off. And there were several hundred other survivors besides them who were their supervisors. But this is the kind of nonsense that we're talking about, where the Americans will say, well, this bomb succeeded, when it was a total strategic failure. It was at that point, just among many other factors, that the Americans knew they had lost the war. Now they're trying to use these Japanese super weapons to help them win a phase of the war which they had lost against the other side, the Nazis, who they are convinced are in Antarctica. So let me put it to you this way. It doesn't matter whether or not you believe that the Nazis were in Antarctica. What matters is that your United States government believed that there were Nazis in Antarctica, and they were willing to expend men and money in order to take them out. So one of the ways that they were doing that was through this Roswell bomb delivery system. It didn't have the parasite fighters, had the parasite bomber that was underslung it. When the Japanese blew that hydrogen, vented all the hydrogen cells, blew the bomb, the super dirigible up, went off like a bomb in midair. They were able to do it because a thunderstorm had broken out, and the escort planes that the Americans had to box them into a certain confined area of airspace were no longer able to spot them clearly. Then at that point, you had a debris field that was created over Billy Mac Brazel's ranch area. Then you had them with the bomb that they had dropped just before they blew themselves over the D. Proctor ranch, which William D. Proctor later on spotted. Now, they disengaged the bomber, which went gliding way over to another area near the plains of San Agustin, where it was spotted by archaeology students and an archaeology professor. And the rest of the dirigible flew up to Corn Ranch, where it was spotted by Trudy Truelove and the guy who was with her out for an amorous adventure. Now, he even spotted these Yakuza, and he mentions this. He said that the aliens, the original report sourcing from him said that they would have bandages all over them. That was from the tattoos being skinned off, and they had bandages all over them. Now, why would aliens have bandages? Were they pre-injured before a crash? That doesn't make sense. He even spotted one of them smoking a cigarette. All of these descriptions get torn to the wayside by different people. And other people who spotted them, say on the plains of San Agustin, said, oh, the MPs approached the aliens, quote unquote, and they were beating them with their rifle butts. Now, who's going to say, you know, and who's going to beat an alien that crashes with a rifle butt? And this is your first contact with an alien civilization, and you're going to beat this guy with a rifle butt. Then there's the people such as what had happened over with William Woody. William Woody is the most important witness to Roswell that nobody ever brings up. 14 years old at the time, or 9 years old, I can't remember exactly which. If you look up William Woody, you'll find his exact age. Him and his father were on the Woody estate, and they spotted the bomber that was disengaged in flames, a long tail, going towards a certain direction. They jumped into their flatbed truck so that they could follow it and ultimately see what it was. They knew it was a craft. They knew it wasn't a meteor because it was going too slow. It was gliding while in flames. They got confronted with a 20-mile cordon of military. Now, there's no way in heaven or earth or hell that when you have a sudden alien crash, you're going to get a 20-mile cordon set up in time.
Mm.
All of this was a pre-planned operation and a test flight to see if it could carry an atomic bomb. Then when Billy Mac Brazel went a few days later with William D. Proctor and they found this oblong-shaped, egg-drop-shaped, teardrop-shaped kind of big Volkswagen-sized shell. That was the atomic shell, plutonium, Fat Man type bomb that was fused shut by the fire had bodies around it, some of the airmen. Everywhere they found this debris, except for the debris field on the Billy Mack Brazel Ranch specifically. And to show you how pioneer-like these people were, he had no plumbing. He had no television. He had no radio. He might have had a radio, but I know for a fact he had no television and he had no plumbing. That's how pioneer life all these people, so many of them were living out there. And so when he went out and with William D. Proctor and they saw the shell, you know, every single one of these components, except for his field on his ranch, had bodies around it. And people were spotting these bodies being put in tarp and all the rest of that, spotting these people, these prisoners of war being abused. To add to that, Life magazine, a photojournalist named Alan Grant, was told to fly over there right away because there was something to do with a prisoner breakout. He flies over there in a single engine, Air Force trainer, and he's confronted by an MP who hands him a Colt 45 with a gun belt. And he's told, you got to protect yourself because we got an enemy alien breakout. And then you have later on a lieutenant or a captain. I can't remember his rank, so people have to look this up. His name was Gleagle. Last name was Gleagle. First name began with an A. I believe it was Adam or something of that nature. A. Gleagle. G-L-E-G-A-L. And this lieutenant or Captain Gleagle had an office in Washington. He was flown to Roswell, and he saw a midget in jail in oversized army fatigues. And this was 1 year after its impact. And they said, yeah, that's a survivor of that crash of illegal enemy aliens and all that stuff. I mean, it just goes on and on. So with all of this going on, where they're filling up all of these transport planes with the rubberized silk, retrieving it from all the residents, putting them under threat, then later on coming back and they say, we got to move we got to move this Roswell Army Airfield. We're going to move it to Texas. And that's one thing that the presidents keep doing. They keep moving all these military bases to Texas so they can go to Texas and get votes because the Texas economy doesn't even float on oil anymore. It floats on military bases. You can jog around Texas for about 3 miles and you'll run into as many military bases, I promise you. And so under the Johnson administration, they took Roswell Army Airfield and they moved it to Texas, all its components. And so Roswell is left with nothing in its economy. That's when you get people... namely Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, who says, well, I can offer you a deal with the devil. I can promote an industry that will make you all rich. And that's when everybody says, okay. And Roswell, as a community, sold its soul to the devil, and since that time has created a church of the alien that they've promoted ever since. And people go there like it's a Mecca, and meanwhile, our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Aquino, is laughing his ass off. This is PSYOP at its most profound because it has the cooperation of the abused.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I tell you, you have put together things here very, very amazingly knit and cross-referenced and touched. And if this is a creation of your mind, you are a genius lunatic because...
I appreciate that. And to put it into perspective for you about how they don't care about you, what the 509th Bomber Group thinks of you, I'll tell you what they think of you. Let me put it to you this way, and people are going to hate me for this. Not only did they lie about stopping the war, not only did they lie about so many other things, beating the sound barrier, that's not the 509th, that's the Army Air Corps, so they could get financing for an Air Force. The very day of the Roswell incident, where was Colonel Blanchard? Colonel Blanchard was meeting with the governor of New Mexico to lobby for a National Air Force holiday that would be started off at the state recognition level in New Mexico. He wanted an Air Force holiday because he's trying to drum up support for an Air Force that doesn't yet exist so that everybody would support the U.S. Army Air Corps. Now, later on, you got poor dopes or saps or victims, would be a better way of putting it without disrespecting them, like the man who was the undertaker, Glenn Miller. And Glenn Miller gets called for all these baby-sized caskets for the Japanese bodies. And so later on, when people keep bringing this up with the 509th, on public television, the 509th representatives came out and they said, oh, infant coffins are used by officers at the Roswell Army Airfield to transport whiskey and other alcohol on airplanes. And we had to develop this smuggling technique to foil the enlisted men from pilfering the goods. They said this on national television. That shows you how much contempt they have for you, because they're telling you to your face that your tax dollars are supporting officers who are running, at that time, the only atomic bomb wing in the what they claim was the world, but was really in the United States. They run the only atomic bomb wing in the United States, and they're telling you they drink on duty.
Well, you know what? The one other thing that comes out of this is that we're looking at what's going on now in the world with the war and all that, and we're looking at these people going like, well, you know, these people are brazen, they're disregarding life, they're doing all this stuff, and if you look at your view of this, or your evidence, and you look at the paradigm through your eyes of what happened before, it's the same thing. I mean, we're not going like, wow, things have gotten this bad, these people are taking... No, this has been how it's been going all along, except in the past, this stuff was so well healed, hid either by the denial of the true patriot American that these things could be lying or whatever. And like today, more people are skeptical, there's the internet, etc. And the belief of the country is gone down and so on. So now this stuff comes out and we go like, wow, how come it wasn't like that before? Well, it was actually. And this is one of the things that you're bringing out.
Yeah, is that basically it was always this bad. that basically this kind of military corruption was just universal, and it was there all along, and this is why they lost the war.
You know, if I can, we still got another segment going, so I don't want to leave anything out. But there's another thing that I find amazing, and it's probably, we talked a little bit off the air about this, so I thought I'd bring it on. It's probably my not having the Eastern mindset, or because what you're saying they have to happen is that Japan clearly was superior in all areas in this war, and the United States sued for peace. And part of the agreement is that it would look Japan allowed the United States to make it look like they lost the war in order for the peace, where they clearly had the upper hand and could have just said, no, we want you to on top TV to grovel and give in to us. And what they allowed to happen was the reverse, or not necessarily groveling, but, and I don't understand that. You know, is that a mindset in the paradigm where it's like, our bottom line here is not the ego, it's the bottom line. And since we won and we're going to have all this stuff, we don't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very pragmatic attitude. The Japanese at that time looked at the Americans as something that they absolutely needed for a higher quality of life. Now, Hirohito was more than willing. The what saved the Americans was the fact that Roosevelt died. And in truth, many of the documents I was dealing with insist he was assassinated. Totally different story. Not to go into right now. He was a very sick man at any rate, both mentally and physically. To give you one idea of how sick he was, when he won the election to his fourth term at the convention, his son had to stand behind him because he had totally collapsed, and his son had to hold him up behind the podium like he was a mannequin. And his eyes were rolled up in his skull, and the searchlights were all on his face, and his son was behind him holding him up like a mannequin. And then his son had to turn around and walk him off the stage, one foot behind the other, totally inert, just like he was a wooden dummy. That's how ill health, that was the kind of ill health this man was in, both physically and mentally, that he would want to keep power while in that condition. Yet he didn't want to let go of power till the day he died, and kept it till the day he died. And he died before Adolf Hitler. He died before the end of the war. That's what saved the United States. Whether he was assassinated or not, his death saved it, because then Truman was brought in. Now, Truman had never been informed about anything, because the original vice president was a communist. And he was such an ardent communist that Roosevelt had to get rid of him, because people were complaining, even in wartime, that this man wanted violent communist revolution to install a Stalinist dictatorship. And so he got rid of that. He brought in Truman. Truman had never met Roosevelt. He had physically been in his proximity only twice, each time for photo shoots. So when he came in, he had no idea about how bad it was until they presented the Hanford Dam incident to him. And what had happened was, while the Americans were firebombing Tokyo, and that was, let me see, that was on the night of March 9th through March 10th of 1945, General Curtis LeMay dropped tons. They sent over hundreds of bombers. They dropped tons and tons of bombs on Tokyo. And in response, Hirohito sent one single balloon bomb. And it flew in low over Yakima Valley, and it destroyed the Hanford Dam, which sent all the power to the Manhattan Project, and the Bonneville Dam in Washington got taken out, and the Manhattan Project was shut down for half a week. And this was just so Hirohito could show the Americans he had mapped the wind current so well, and he knew where they were putting together the components for their atomic bomb, even right down to the power line. All right. That's how bad it was when Truman became president.
All righty, hold on there. We're going to take a little break and come back with the final segment. I got a couple of questions I'd like to ask you in application of that. Like, given this, then why this type questions,
yeah.
If I can do this. So yeah. Hold on. We'll take a break. And, of course, anything else he wants to add into it. Douglas Dietrich giving us a lot of information to chew on, listen to. This is one of those shows you're going to listen to many times. If you don't, you're aggravated by it, you won't. But if you... All right, I want to find out what's going on. It might be interested to listen a few times, so hold on. Most people think of addictions relating to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. However, obsessive-compulsive actions taken to excessive levels have the same biochemical goal. They stimulate the creation of natural feel-good hormones, but at a cost that causes more harm in the long run. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com. Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organics seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll-free in the United States and Canada at...
Well, tonight's show is new material. It is pre-recorded, therefore the phone lines are not in operation.
If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose Direct Chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@ipsmediaworks.net. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancey.
You know, one thing I tell you one thing that's really good about this is to put a perspective, to look today where we're at. And there is an encouragement to it in that back then this stuff was rock solid, hidden from the public. I mean, it was like nobody, you know, it was not even an issue. But now these things, the same scenarios are happening. They use the same techniques, the same deal, and it's not flying as well. So either we're getting a little bit more knowledgeable and open because of things like the internet and people like Douglas, and also they're getting more and more inept. So that combination, hopefully, it intersects at a point where we can save this thing before it goes into the toilet. But we were talking with Douglas Dietrich. DouglasDietrich.com is the website where you could find the DVDs and so forth and so on that can go into these things. I tell you, it's one thing to hear him talk about. It's another thing to have him see the evidence, which he has taken pictures of or taken rather than destroying, which was his job to do, was destroy all this material. So here he is. He's seen it, and he has some of it, including a piece from the, quote, Roswell crash, unquote. Amazing, amazing stuff. And welcome back, Douglas.
Yes, thank you. And I do want to address the Japanese psychology. Basically, because of everything that was going on with Roosevelt and the leadership in America, the Japanese felt that when it came to the American leadership, it was like humoring a madman. And so all they cared about was, you keep the emperor in power, and Emperor Hirohito wound up winning his war. We have to remember that here was a man who died in about 1989. He had outlived Roosevelt. He had outlived Truman. He had outlived Eisenhower. He had outlived Stalin. He had outlived Charles de Gaulle. He had outlived Winston Churchill, and he was still constitutionally the emperor. And Japan is still legally an empire because its constitutional monarchy is still internationally recognized. And he was basically running one of the most prosperous economies in the world. And our economy was far more dependent on theirs than theirs was on ours by that time. But initially, in order to deliver his nation from a post-Vietnam War era style of poverty. See, when you have somebody like Vietnam, which won the war militarily, at least towards the end, that would take an entire different show. The American Army behaved actually fairly well combat-wise in the field. The Marine Corps, even better. It can be claimed America won most of the battles militarily in Vietnam, and that the Vietnamese won politically. But in the end, it can't be argued, they won militarily in the last few years with the American Vietnamization of the war. And they wound up paying the price with poverty for the next half century. For Japan to avoid that fate, winning militarily and then spending the next several decades in poverty, Hirohito had to convince the Americans to open the largest, most wealthiest market on Earth. That's why he went for a negotiated ceasefire and forcing the Americans into it rather than killing everybody. Now, instead of lording it over them and boastfully bragging about it and making himself insufferable, he was more than happy for the sake of his people to go into a phase of constitutional monarchy, which the Japanese always had, and simply withdraw more from public life because he had done his duty for his people. And at that time, the Japanese leadership viewed the American leaderships as essentially insane. And one can't blame them. And the end result is, when I was in criminology courses, when I was in criminology in City College of San Francisco, and we were taking like criminology courses in things like child molestation and pedophilia, these various abuses, which I compare the entire community of Roswell as to having suffered and become a co-abuser in, they showed that Americans had a much higher level of pedophilia than any other culture on earth. And they were also showing the difference in cultures in terms of response to violent crimes against children or horrible crimes in general. And so one psychologist was bringing in people from different cultures, and he would show them footage of violent scenes while the psychologist pretended to laugh and have this sadistic, gleeful, he pretended to be taking maniacal delight in other people's misfortune as portrayed on the screen. And so they brought in a Japanese man, and the Japanese man just felt it was his duty to laugh along with this guy until the guy left the room. Then the Japanese man was obviously very disturbed and very upset by what he was seeing on the screen. So the Japanese culture, in a very real sense, was going along with the game with the Americans like that. The Japanese are famous for not saying what they mean. All the American, Australian, or Allied prisoners of war who were prisoners of war throughout the Pacific conflict would testify to the fact that the Japanese would often say, "So sorry," whenever they ask for medical supplies. "So sorry," whenever they ask for extra food. "So sorry." You know, anything from, "Yeah, I could easily get this for you, but I won't," to "tough cheese." But it never really meant, "I'm sorry." There's a real indirect method of communication that the Japanese have that is at play here. And it just goes on and on. But the anthropological and behavioral examples are that the Japanese, to the Americans, truly do have an alien mindset. And that is why the Americans were so incapable of confronting this as opposed to a European enemy with any great effectiveness, any more than they were able to confront it in Korea or Vietnam. And that's what the Japanese had ultimately pioneered, was that kind of warfare. The Americans occupied Korea all the while they were fighting the Koreans. The Americans occupied Vietnam all the while they were fighting the Vietnamese. The Americans occupied Japan all the while they were fighting the other phase of the Japanese conflict, which was on the Chinese mainland. I was born in Taiwan, where the nationalist Chinese government reestablished itself, and that was in 1949. Now, Taiwan was never invaded. It was an integral part of Japan. And suddenly, the nationalist Chinese government reestablishes itself there because the Japanese gave that to them in exchange for allowing Japanese forces to stay in China until the nationalist Chinese government withdrew, which was 1949. So until 1949, America was threatened by Japanese balloon super dirigible bombs out of China until that point in time. And that's why the Americans had excuses like the Mogul Balloon Bomb Project. And they'll say stupid things, asinine things, like, "Oh, we were trying to keep track of Soviet atomic explosions." Well, the Soviets didn't explode their first atomic bomb until August of 1949, which was like 2 years after the Roswell incident, and maybe even later than that by a few months. So that excuse doesn't even wash. And to give you an idea of how alien the technology was, because they kept referring to Japanese biomimetic technology that looked like living things, these constructs that Emperor Hirohito, as a marine biologist, had designed, they kept referring to it as alien technology. So what happened to Jesse Marceau, Sr.? Well, at Strategic Air Command, Marceau was given the title Chief Technical Trends and Developments, Aliens Capability Section, Intelligence Division Headquarters. Now, doesn't anyone look at that and say, what is wrong with this picture? And suddenly this guy finds all this technology and says, this is alien technology, to his son. That's exactly what he means. It's Japanese technology. It's enemy alien technology.
Yeah, literally alien in the sense of not from this country.
Legal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the legal sense, in the litigious sense. Now, keep in mind, the California Constitution, which was all about keeping away illegal enemy aliens like Asians, specifically the Chinese, then later on used as a national model for the Japanese, it's still in effect today, but until very recently, it referred to all of Asians as enemy aliens, as illegal aliens, as an alien presence. These are all litigious terms. They go back to the Alien Exclusion Act of the 1920s, dealing with Asians specifically as an ethnic group. And you have to remember, all of this was in military terminology, legal terminology for decades, got brainwashed into the American public, then it got confused with extraterrestrials by Army design. In 1947, people can look this up, Buck Rogers comic strips, which made national newspapers, every day people would open their newspapers, nationwide, they would read Buck Rogers' comic strip. And in 1947, the year of the Roswell incident, they added a new chapter to the Buck Rogers saga called Dr. Mortar of Saturn. Mortar was spelled M-O-R-D-A-R. And they showed this alien gray as Dr. Mortar, and he commanded a whole army of alien Orientals from Saturn, and Buck Rogers is fighting them. They all have slanted eyes and buck teeth, and he's calling them all gooks. So Asians became aliens at that point. And this is after the so-called ceasefire. And Truman, he paid the price because he knew everything that was going on. This is why people said, oh, Truman was first had top secret negotiations with aliens. Then Eisenhower had top secret negotiations with aliens. Yeah, they were dealing with Japan until 1951 when the peace treaty was signed. And Truman paid the price because he wanted to basically come out with it. And the U.S. Army destroyed him. I mean, basically what had happened was he was accused of harboring spies in government. They said that there was corruption in the Oval Office. Seven members of Truman's administration, including some of his closest aides, were imprisoned. Republicans scored 52% of the vote in the 1950 congressional elections, while Truman's own party got a mere 42%, saw its majority in the Senate cut from 12 to 2, and in the House from 17 to 12. Just 2 weeks before his election, when he was trying to get reelected or elected for the first time as president, because he had been brought in based on Roosevelt's death, so-called Puerto Rican nationalists who wanted Puerto Rican independence stormed Blair House. Now, it was a top secret that he was a top-level secret. I mean, higher than top-secret level, something that was really secret, that he was living at Blair House because the White House was being renovated. So only a few people knew he was living at Blair House. Suddenly, this hit squad hits Blair House. The assassination attempt fails, but only because his car broke down on the way home. If he hadn't been 20 minutes late, he would have been, the 33rd president of the United States would have been assassinated. As it was, the fusillade that engulfed the Blair House from all sides killed a policeman and a security guard. And, you know, then you had the Alger Hiss passing secrets to the communists accusation. Senator Joseph McCarthy, a former tail gunner in the U.S. Army Air Corps, brandished a list of 205 known communists in the State Department during a speech in West Virginia. Everything came crashing down for Truman. His life was made a living hell, and he was known, they called it bombarding him. They bombarded him the way they later on swift-boated Kerry in the elections, and they destroyed him. And that's why Eisenhower came into power later on, behaved like a good boy, kept his mouth shut, finished up the peace talks with the Japanese. Then when he left, said something about the military-industrial complex. And everybody thinks he's courageous for that. All he was doing was acknowledging what the military-industrial complex had done to Truman. Because he knew exactly what they had done to him. And so now you're left with this legacy of lies and deceit. And I'm hoping that by bringing it out to the American public, they can come to grips with what my father said needs to be called the GI generation. Because they were brainwashed. They did what they were ordered to do. They were government issue. They asked no questions. And they believed whatever Uncle Sam told them. And my father, who was in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He was in the China gunboat patrols at the time that the USS Pan A was being bombed in December 13th of 1937. And he said, after being through all those wars, he said he got so angry whenever they referred to the World War II generation as the greatest generation. He said the greatest generation will be whichever generation is able to correct all of the mistakes that we made. And he couldn't understand this whole greatest generation stuff. That's another part of the emotive programming that they give you when they talk about the 509th, that these people say Roswell was real, and that's why you got to believe in aliens, because the greatest generation says the aliens are real. Well, the GI generation. They did what they were told. They believed what they were told. But in terms of the Greatest Generation, we're talking about the people who interred 120,000 Japanese Americans who had been here for three generations. They had legally purchased so much land in the center of California, San Joaquin Valley, that on official government maps that I was ordered to destroy, it used to refer to San Joaquin Valley in California, the most fertile land on the face of the earth at that time, used to refer to it as Jap Valley. Used to be listed on that as civilian maps as well. You know, very few places you'll find those maps these days. And the whole thing about that was that the Office of Alien Property was organized to steal all of their real fiscal and personal belongings and property, deprive them of their citizenship. Martial law had never been declared, so all civil statutes were still in effect. And they did all this in the face of the American public with their agreement. Whatever one says about the Third Reich, the Nazi Party was legally voted in, but their Konzertslagen, the concentration camps, and their Totenslagen, the death camps, were kept secret from the taxpaying public of the Third Reich. And no one can deny this, that they kept that as a covert program. As a matter of fact, Adolf Hitler couldn't get enough cooperation from the Wehrmacht and the armed forces, so he had to create a second army, the SS, to carry out the vanguard duties of the Holocaust. The Americans didn't need to do any of that. When Roosevelt ordered all the Japanese interred, one man stood up, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI. He said, "Mr. Roosevelt, this is unconstitutional, and I will not partake in this." And Roosevelt said, "F you, I'll have the Army do it."
Now, granted, Hoover's not exactly, you know, Mr. Sunday school teacher, upstanding citizen, and even he objected to it.
That's right. He was the only man in the United States who is on record as having done so. That really ought to tell you something. Even the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples, which was around at that time to advocate for civil rights, wouldn't say anything. This is what led to Japanese anti-African-American racism for the next several decades. Because the only other colored people of a notable minority wouldn't help them in their hour of need. And at that time, when the Japanese were robbed of their citizenship and the Office of Alien Property was created to take all their property away, they were all stuck in internment camps. I'll say it publicly right now. I'm 25% Japanese. By law, at that time, I would have been taken into an internment camp. Now, these people were of a different mentality. They wanted to be white so bad they could taste it. And not only that, who would fight for a nation who put their family in a concentration camp? Well, they weren't left with any choice. The 442nd got more Congressional Medals of Honor than any other division in the history of the United States. And to show you how difficult it is to get a Congressional Medal of Honor, most people who get it are dead. And beyond that, it's so important they don't allow any forgeries, even on G.I. Joe dolls. They don't even allow simulacra of the Professional Medal of Honor. They recalled G.I. Joe dolls who had Congressional Medals of Honor that were 1/12 size. And the reason they take this so seriously is because if you win the Congressional Medal of Honor, you will never have to pay income taxes again for the rest of your life. And that's why they take it so seriously. Now, the Japanese 442nd won more Congressional Medals of Honor as a unit than any other unit in American history. And why? Because they were told, "We got your families in a concentration camp, and by God, we'll skin them alive. We're going to impale
you,
your wife."
And people would say, "Well, that's outrageous." Yeah, what's going on in Guantanamo? You know, yeah. I mean, here we go. You know, there's stuff happening today that we're looking at as a new event that maybe has been standing operating procedure and now is getting finally looked at in the light of day.
That's right. And these veterans of the Japanese 442nd, they never talk. They never talk and about this sort of thing. But I dealt with the records and I destroyed them, and I know what was going on. And so in terms of that kind of hideousness, how can you say that a generation that would abide by that, again, what I said about the Nazis making their bit covert, you know, they had to create a second army to be the vanguard of the Holocaust. The Americans didn't need to do that. The American government went before the American people. They didn't need to be, they were totally overt about it. They said, "We're going to take these people because they're a different ethnicity. We're going to deprive them of all rights without declaring martial law while civil rights statutes are still in effect. And we're going to steal everything from them, sell it to white people for pennies on the dollar. And we're going to do this. What do you think?" And all the American people said, "That's cool. We dig it. We want it." And with 100% support of the GI generation, this atrocity took place. And now because of that, decades later, in retroactively, the Supreme Court said, oh, it's all constitutional. And because of that extremely dangerous decision, the most bizarre and convoluted ever handed down by that tribunal, no one is safe. And at any point, now you have an ethnic president, possibly the first of many, and he may not even be an American citizen. And now the whites, the Caucasians, are the minority. Perhaps at some point in the future, someone's going to say, let's put all the whites in internment camps.
Or at
and
least,
they have legal precedent.
Yeah, or at least, you know, talking about people who are into the Constitution and so on.
Yeah, well, anyone, selectively.
Yeah,
no
yeah.
individual is safe.
And of course, they've passed laws that have now make it totally legal to do things like that. I mean, it's actually laws that have been passed and signed by Congress.
They're redundant. They're simply redundant. But in terms of how it happens to any individual, Nikola Tesla in 1943 was so disgusted with what the Americans wanted him to do with the Philadelphia experiment. He said, the Americans are insane. And he was up to here with the robber barons, like Thomas Edison and J.P. Morgan, who had so used and abused and exploited him. So his nephew was a Yugoslav diplomat. He said, take all of these documents, everything you can carry, bring them back to my homeland of Yugoslavia, and make sure this becomes the property of all mankind, because the Americans will use this to conquer mankind and enslave it forever. And so his nephew, the Yugoslav diplomat, brought it back. Unfortunately, at that time, Yugoslavia was in the midst of World War II and a vicious civil war. And Croatia was an active Axis satellite. That's how the Third Reich wound up with Tesla technology. Serbia was invaded by the communists, and that's how the Soviet Union wound up with Tesla technology. Nevertheless, it probably went as Tesla planned it, because at least now there were two powers in the world who had his technology that could stave off the United States. Well, the U.S. was so angry, they deprived him of his American citizenship and said, we're coming to take you into an internment camp just like any Jap. And he killed himself, according to all the documents I dealt with. And his proudest possession was his U.S. citizenship certificate, which he kept in his safe in New York. Any biographer of Tesla will tell you that. And he finally, in the end, had to kill himself because of what the United States did to him. And who took his property? Who took everything that was left in his offices? OAP, Office of Alien Property. The same office, not the FBI. OAP. Anybody who does research on this will verify what I am saying. And Frank J. Edgar Hoover, who had stood up to the president about the internment camps, that's why the army had to handle it. Roosevelt didn't even need to create a special army. He had normal American army put people in concentration camps. And so this is the kind of system we're talking about. You didn't need any elite forces to be the vanguard for this. The American public openly was supportive of this dehumanization, this internment. How can you expect this generation to look at what happened at Roswell with a sane, balanced perspective and see human beings as what they are? All they could see was aliens. I mean, this, I hope, puts it into perspective for people today. You know, I really need you to follow up with some questions now, because I think, understandably, my point is there is no secret dirtier than this. And it gets worse. To fight the Japanese fires that all those incendiary balloons caused, many people know about the 555th, the Triple Nickels. Well, the Triple Nickels was not just that military unit of elite firefighters. Those men were like human jets. They used to call the program Jet Black. And the reason why was, just like the German jets were thrown up against hundreds of American bombers, thousands of them, the Americans turned out a bomber every 20 minutes. Every 20 minutes, they turned out a bomber. So no matter how many jets the Germans threw up in the air against these bombers, the Americans had more bombers than even their jets could take down. So the Japanese were throwing in all these cheap rubberized silk glued together with rice paper and candy. Literally, edible candies were gluing together these bombs. The Americans couldn't throw up enough firefighters put out the fires these Japanese balloons were starting. So, by the way, are we at the end of the show?
Yeah,
or do we have?
We're at the end of the show. It's 3 hours.
Oh, my God. Well, my point was, they sent hundreds of African-Americans to the death fighting this, who were part of a different Triple Nickels program that was under the supposedly liquidated CCC. Now, with all this to hide, is there any reason why they wouldn't hide it with the biggest propaganda and PSYOP campaign you've ever seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the alien stuff happened and they went, hey, this is good stuff. This is good stuff, you know, and that's why it's been so hush-hush, because if people actually dig they'll find these other things. Well, Douglas, I'm telling you, this has been and I haven't said much purposely because you have such a great stuff on here. So what I'm looking for now is you've had three shows, two of them are basically World War II related and the other one. And if people want out there want to get together, anybody you mentioned, I'm here, and I appreciate your time. And boy, we got to run, but thank you for stopping by here, Douglas.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor. Blessings to all of you. Thank you for your patience. And check my website, DouglasDietrich.com.
That's right. I just want to mention that. And that's Diet Rich. I will never forget that. Thank you, Douglas. DouglasDietrich.com. All right. I'm on the road. We'll be back next week. Reach for the skies within. Remember, truth will set you free, as painful as it may be. And you have to test it against reality with logic and evidence. So hang in there. We'll be back.
With wisdom for the new, revive our inner sight, retell your timeless truths. Oh, each one.
Feet to Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the OnSIC Radio Network of Stations.